Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Freedom Now Movement, hear me. We are requesting all citizens to move into Washington, to go by plane, by car, bus. We are pushing for jobs, housing, desegregated schools. Please join. Go to Washington.
On August 28, 1963, the Robinson family joined more than a quarter of a million Americans in Washington, D.C., in a peaceful show of hope and racial unity.
Well, I know. If it hits you, you say, oh, yes, you will now. I want to tell you, it's going to get you.
I was 11 years old. For an 11-year-old kid, in the heart of it, with his father's arm, you know, over his shoulder, as the protector and leader into this world, it was a fantastic day for myself personally, and I think for us as a nation, us as a race.
I remember the feel of, you know, being in a wave and being part of something bigger than yourself, and that's a very great feeling.
The Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
I have never been so proud to be a Negro, Robinson wrote. I have never been so proud to be an American.
The March on Washington is a watershed moment in the movement itself. But this is also a turning point in terms of the violence that we associate with the movement and the escalation of opposition. Because the fear is that a civil rights bill is coming. It's only a month later that you have the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, and killing of four little girls.
How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? And at the same time,
after the church bombing in Birmingham, Jackie Robinson helped organize the rally in front of the Hotel Teresa on 125th Street in Harlem. The first speaker was a charismatic minister from the Nation of Islam who had developed a devoted following by condemning nonviolent measures and preaching independence from whites. His name was Malcolm X. As a 21-year-old serving time in a Massachusetts prison for burglary, Malcolm Little had followed each at-bat of Jackie's rookie season. Robinson, he remembered, had his most fanatic fan in me. When Jackie returned to the stage to end the Harlem rally, the crowd had begun chanting, "We want Malcolm." Soon they had grown more boisterous, drowning out Robinson. Malcolm X had been watching from in front of a nearby Chock-Full-O-Nuts coffee shop. He climbed up on the platform again and encouraged everyone to go home. The crowd dispersed.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 5th, 2016. So I have been told. We are picking up. This is our fourth study session on Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. The book is written by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. We are picking up Chapter 6. We are towards the end of Chapter 6. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that is from the PBS documentary film Jackie Robinson, that aired earlier this year in the springtime. Jackie Robinson will be making a cameo appearance in the portion of the reading that we will cover this week. They will be talking in some detail about the 1963 March on Washington. Without further ado, we will get started. Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, context of white supremacy, audio segment number one.
On March 6th, a large gathering of reporters and radio and television men greeted Clay when he stepped off the train at Pennsylvania Station. Wearing a brown sports jacket and gray slacks, he looked fresh after a long ride from Miami, but his voice was subdued, at least at first. Was he surprised that the fight had attracted so much interest? A sports writer asked. That's only natural, he said, matter-of-factly. The fans know what they want. They're coming to see me. To see the greatest. It was the beginning of Operation Hype, but his quips were not covered in the Times, Daily News, Herald Tribune, Journal American, or any other New York City newspaper. The timing of Clay's campaign could hardly have been worse. Cassius, the sports writer's dream, was silenced by an army of linotype workers, photo engravers, paper handlers, office boys, and other members of Local Number 6 of the International Typographical Union and a patchwork of affiliated organizations. They had gone on strike against the owners and publishers of New York City's seven major newspapers, walking off their posts on December 8, 1962, and not returning for 114 days. For New York sports fans and gossip devotees, it was like a citywide blackout. The strike cut off the circulation of 5.7 million daily and 7.2 million Sunday newspaper copies in a city where newspapers dictated the rhythms of millions of lives. No Arthur Daly and Gay Talese, New York Times, or Red Smith, New York Herald Tribune, with their morning coffee. No Dick Young, New York Daily News, or Walter Winchell, New York Daily Mirror, for their subway rides to work. No Milton Gross, New York Post, for their subway rides home. No Dan Parker and Jimmy Cannon, New York Journal American, or Westbrook Pegler, New York World Telegram and Sun, as they relaxed after dinner. Although on February 28, 1963, New York Post publisher Dorothy Shift abandoned the other owners and resumed the publication of her paper, the rest of the magnates grimly fought the unions. Of all sports, the strike had the greatest impact on boxing. The major professional and college team sports have their seasons, with game schedules and times readily available and widely distributed. But boxing has no such predictability. Matches are made and scheduled willy-nilly, and promoters depended on sports writers to promote the contests by visiting training camps, interviewing combatants, and generally creating the sense that each upcoming battle promised to be the greatest grudge fight since the Paleolithic era. It was the sports writers who awarded the pugilists personality quirks, created heroes and villains, and imbued the sport with drama. Better than any other fighter, Clay understood the role of sports writers and sought to give them what they wanted, when they wanted it. Arriving in a city where he had an upcoming fight,
He acted like he was running for mayor, prepared to talk to every voter and kiss every baby. There was hardly a newspaper, television, or radio reporter whose attention he did not covet. "The only ones I send away," he admitted, "are those guys from the little radio stations. They put you on at 4:30 in the afternoon when no one's at home and no one's listening." But with New York newspaper writers carrying placards on picket lines, Cassius had to find other ways to spread his message. Before the strike, television news was hardly worthy of the name, mostly providing 15 minutes of local tragedies, weather reports, and a few game scores. What hard news the telecasters reported was what they read in the morning New York Times. The strike presented them with a challenge and an opportunity. WCBS added $50,000 to its weekly news budget and hired 18 news reporters. WNBC expanded from a 15-minute newscast to a half hour. The city turned to television for its news, as never before. Cassius's routine played even better on screen than in print. The week before the fight, he appeared on The Today Show, The Tonight Show, and once again on The Ed Sullivan Show. Showing no physical evidence of his profession, he was polite, articulate, and handsome, looking and sounding like the anti-boxer. Since the death of Benny the Kid Perrette, news reports and documentaries had fed Americans a succession of stories about punch-drunk, broken-nosed, down-at-the-heels fighters. But now here was Cassius Clay, looking more like a movie star than a boxer, talking to Johnny Carson, Hugh Downs, and Ed Sullivan, demonstrating complete poise and humor. He also made personal appearances designed to attract media attention. On March 7th, just before he went on The Tonight Show, he headlined a unique media event. Dressed for the occasion, he ventured down to the Bitter End on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village for a noontime poetry reading contest. He looked as out of place in the legendary coffee house as Allen Ginsberg would have appeared in the ring at Madison Square Garden. In front of an international audience of writers and curious out-of-towners, a group of poets read their verse. Unimpressed with the poets, Cassius read his own predictable doggerel. "The word's been passed around that I'm a very charming guy, the greatest fighter that ever lived, and I'll gladly tell you why. My secret is self-confidence, a champion at birth. I'm lyrical, I'm fresh, I'm smart. My fists have proved my worth." Laughter and applause punctuated his reading, and the New York Post's Pete Hamill acclaimed him the messiah of the poetry racket, who had annihilated with one terrible stroke the frail world of beat poets, square poets, academic poets, and zen poets, anti-poet poets, jazz poets, and lady poets. Throughout the week, Clay worked every angle. From TV shows to standing on street corners and singing his own praises, he did not miss an opportunity to promote himself. His one-man publicity campaign demonstrated that he was just as unique as he claimed. There had been television boxers before him, but he was the first boxer who belonged to the television age, the first to understand how to use the medium to project an image and sell an event. Like Chubby Checker, father of the twist dance craze, Cassius realized that fame was just a matter of delivering the same message 10,000 times. A.J. Liebling noted, "The more he bragged, the more of a drawing card he became, although he certainly did not understand the mechanics of this phenomenon." But Liebling was wrong. Clay fully understood. He knew that his words created a media buzz that produced a honey jar of cash. Doug Jones knew it as well. While Clay worked to build the gate, Jones quietly trained. With what one reporter described as a catfish-style mustache and another called a cue-ball-shaped head, he had the look of an interesting character, but he said very little to bring attention to himself. Asked if he resented Clay's constant verbal attacks, he shook his head no. "Let that Cassius keep talking. The more he talks, the more money I'll make." By Wednesday, March 13th, the morning of the fight, Clay had had his lengthy say. Unable to sleep, he was up and dressed by 6:30 a.m., slipping unobserved from his room at the Plymouth Hotel, he walked 2 blocks to Madison Square Garden and looked at the large marquee. Tonight, boxing, Clay versus Jones. At the ticket booth, he saw a smaller sign that read, "Sold out." For the first time in 6 years, all of the Garden's 18,732 seats were sold out. It was the first time they had ever sold out ahead of time. It was tangible proof of his assertions that he was the savior of boxing, hard evidence that the sport was not dying. It was the stuff of his childhood dreams, of fame and wealth. As he had said earlier in the week, "That Jones, that ugly man, I'll annihilate him. You know what this fight means to me? A tomato-red Cadillac Eldorado convertible with white leather upholstery, air conditioning, and hi-fi. That's what the Louisville sponsoring group is giving me for a victory present. Can you picture me losing to this ugly bum Jones with that kind of swinging car waiting for me?" Clay walked into the weigh-in that afternoon with a 2-inch-wide strip of adhesive tape over his mouth, signaling that he was through talking, though he was not done communicating. When Jones stepped onto the scale, Cassius held up 4 fingers. Doug Jones, a fighter in his prime who had never been stopped, would fall in 4, just like old Archie Moore. Later that afternoon, as Cassius was resting in his room, he received an unusual visitor. A black man with a mobile face that displayed his every emotion walked into the room, which was easier than it sounds, because people were always coming and going around the boxer. He took one look at the cluttered room, with clothes, fight equipment, and shoes tossed about haphazardly, and began to give orders. "Who takes care of you?" he asked. Clay pointed to a white man seated in the corner, smoking a cigar. The stranger then barked orders at the white man. He said Cassius's shoes needed polish, suggesting precisely the brand of wax to use, and that the boxer's socks needed washing, and that the white man better move fast because a fighter packing people into the Garden up to the rafters and the seats where before there was nothing there but pigeons needed to be serviced just right. The stranger was Drew Bundini Brown. Like Clay himself, Bundini was a larger-than-life self-creation. He had walked uninvited into the boxer's world and decided to stay. When Clay left to go to Madison Square Garden in a limousine, Bundini sat in the back seat with him. When the traffic slowed the limo to a crawl, Bundini ordered the driver to maneuver onto the sidewalk. When several policemen came running, Bundini told them that Cassius was in the car, and if it weren't for him, they wouldn't be out there on duty. Sugar Ray, they let him park on the sidewalk. Everything he said made sense, and everyone seemed to follow his orders. It seemed only natural that he floated alongside Cassius, past the Garden's entrance, and into his life. Unlike Cassius and Bundini, A.J. Liebling did not float into the Garden. He struggled through a throng of people coming in the opposite direction. They were coming away from it because the house was sold out, a report that they had refused to believe, and the cops were chasing them out of the lobby, where they were blocking the entrance. Remembering the meager turnout the year before for Clay's first New York match, Liebling reflected on the drawing power of this poet-boxer, whom he had dubbed Apollo, the god of truth, prophecy, music, and poetry. Could Paul Valéry have filled the Veldive, he wondered, or Keats, Her Majesty's Theater? The greatest venue in pugilism bubbled with life, and in the lobby, Liebling thought that he saw the life-size bronze statue of Joe Gans, a champion from early in the century, break into a sweat of excitement. The reporter had not seen such a high time since the up-and-coming Rocky Marciano sent the great Joe Louis into permanent retirement. Arriving early to his seat in the press row, he watched the Garden fill from the rafters to ringside. Sitting nearest the action and pulling hard for Cassius were the elite of Louisville, Ross Todd and his father, Juette Ross Todd, up from their winter home in Nassau, Mr. and Mrs. Worth Bingham, down from a skiing vacation in New England, and, of course, William Faversham, Gordon Davidson, and other members of the Louisville sponsoring group. Not far from the august group of Southerners were dignitaries from Black America. Legendary baseball player and activist Jackie Robinson sat near tennis great Althea Gibson, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Ralph Bunche was not far off. Malcolm X was also perched at ringside, though none of the sports writers commented about how unusual it was that one of the two most recognizable figures in the Nation of Islam attended the fight. Looking around the garden, Malcolm realized that all of the people there had come to see one man, Cassius Clay. He had never seen so many people drawn to an event because of a single black man. Not even Elijah Muhammad, he thought, could fill the garden. Malcolm was joined by athletic luminaries and politicians, including Sugar Ray Robinson, Jack Dempsey, Gene Tunney, and members of the Joint Legislative Committee on Professional Boxing, down from Albany to get a closer look at the sport's nefarious activities. They were all there to see if Apollo, a solid 3-1 favorite, would finish the shaven-headed fighter with a catfish mustache in the fourth round. It was a curious fight crowd, not so much pro-Jones as anti-Clay. Cassius had played the villain during his promotion of the fight, and the spectators treated him as such as he made his way to the ring. Jeers trailed him as he slid between the ropes. In what Liebling labeled the most emphatic anti-poetry demonstration in American history, the spectators registered their disapproval for Clay's act. The first round began predictably. Clay came out on his toes, circling away from Jones's left leads, flicking out whip-like jabs meant to aggravate more than injure. His head down and protected by his hands, Jones moved straight forward in a direct, no-nonsense fashion, his eyes locked on Clay, looking to land power punches. Both fighters concentrated on headshots, avoiding body punches, as if they had been outlawed for the fight. Less than a minute into the bout, Clay made a critical error. Since his amateur days, conventional boxing experts had criticized his habit of avoiding punches by moving straight back instead of slipping to one side or the other. It was like avoiding a speeding train by backing up on the tracks rather than jumping off them. Now, as Cassius pulled back, Jones leaped forward with a sweeping right hand, landing with devastating power on Clay's chin. Cassius's knees buckled momentarily as he stumbled back into the corner ropes, hitting them hard and bouncing off into a charging Jones. He was hurt, and as the over 18,000 spectators in the garden rose out of their seats as if they had been shocked, Jones pressed his advantage. Cassius grabbed Jones's arms, pulled him close, and hugged him like a long-lost friend, placing his face cheek to cheek with his opponent's. The desperate maneuver gave him 10 or so seconds to clear his head and steady his legs. When the referee pried them apart, Clay fought like a seasoned professional. He backpedaled, pushed out defensive jabs designed to keep Jones at a distance, and gave himself more time to run a check on his senses. A half minute later, he was out of danger and back in control of the fight. Jones had missed an opportunity, and Clay was wiser for the exchange. He had taken Jones's best punch, and now he knew just how fast the Harlem fighter could strike. After the first round, the fight settled into a pattern. Jones worked to connect with another hard right, and Clay fought from a distance, content to score points and avoid damage. Neither combatant was very aggressive, and Liebling contended that both had repertories as limited as the club fighters. In the next two rounds, Clay landed the most punches, but when Jones reached Cassius with anything approaching a clean shot, the garden exploded with cheering. It was the sort of match that the judges had to watch carefully with their eyes so they would not be influenced by their ears. There was another factor that played against Cassius, his prediction. At the weigh-in, he had boasted, "I'm changing the pick I made before. Instead of 6, Doug goes in 4. If he did not fulfill his prophecy, the partisan fans would interpret it as a victory for Jones. And although he increased his attack in the fourth, he was unable to hurt, let alone finish, his opponent. As the big electric clock in the garden counted down the seconds in the round and Jones remained upright and strong, the jeers and catcalls built like the climax of a Beethoven symphony. The spectators felt cheated, and they rained insults into the ring. "Clay, you're a big bum! Nothing but a bum!" a ringsider shouted. "You can't fight or write poetry!" cried another. The round ended with Clay landing a hard right at the bell, which created another stir of discontent. The round had come and gone, and Doug Jones moved briskly back to his corner, with no sign of damage. In the middle rounds, Jones fought Clay evenly, but the unconditional support of the spectators made it seem like he was winning. In Clay's corner, watching the action and listening to the fervor, Angelo Dundee was alarmed. After the seventh round, he felt the fight slipping away. Imploring Clay to action, he told him he could kiss Tomato Red goodbye. That got Cassius's attention. "Dundee shook me up," he said after the fight. "I came out in the eighth saying, 'So long, Dougie. Hello, Tomato Red.'" In the last three rounds, Clay consistently landed three or four times as many shots as Jones did. He fought with heart, cutting the distance between Jones and him, and taking more chances. Victory, at this juncture, was more important than survival. Following the fight from just behind Clay's corner, Bundini Brown beamed. "When I saw how he bear down and start beating the man to death, he made me fall in love. I was with him from that fight on." The pause between the final bell and the decision seemed interminable. Finally, announcer Johnny Addy approached the microphone. "Both of the judges, Artie Idala and Frank Forbes, they score it this way. 5-4, one even, in favor of Clay." Cassius had won, and boos showered the ring. Undeterred, the unflappable Addy finished his chores, though the booing made it difficult. "Referee, referee, referee Joe Loscalzo had it 8-1, one even, Clay. The winner by unanimous decision, Cassius Clay." And the floodgates of discontent opened wide. Spectators screamed and jeered, held their heads in amazement, and looked dumbfounded, protesting with all their faculties what they considered a miscarriage of justice. Cassius egged them on. He raised his hands, opened his mouth wide, mimicked the booing fans while he mugged for the cameras, and stuck out his tongue. As he began the ring interview with Don Dunphy, the spectators commenced a chant, "Fix! Fix! Fix!" Then, "Fake! Fake! Fake!" As Cassius told Dunphy that he did not want to fight Jones again and that he was ready for Sonny Liston, spectators started to throw bottles, programs, crumpled cigarette packs, cardboard drinking cups, and whatever was at hand into the ring. Some tossed unshelled peanuts. One pitched his switchblade. Cassius smiled as he gathered, shucked, and ate a few peanuts. A short time later, he asked a reporter, "Why did those people boo me when I whoop him? Why don't they boo for me?" In the packed Miami Beach auditorium, Liston had watched the match in a theater on closed circuit. He smiled when Cassius said he wanted to fight him for the title. "What did Clay show him?" someone asked. "He can't punch. Clay showed me I'll get locked up for murder if we're ever matched." He added, "He don't know how to duck. He don't even know how to run. He don't know how to do anything." But the packed garden and impassioned fans showed Sonny something else. Boxing fans, that dying species, had been resuscitated and would pay to see someone close the Louisville lip. Just over a week after he defeated Jones, Cassius's notoriety reached a landmark when he was featured in a portrait on the cover of Time, the country's leading weekly news magazine. The drawing had two main parts, a book and the man. The illustration of the boxer hardly looks like him. The skin is darker, the features more coarse. Above his head, two boxing gloves hold open a book of poetry, looking remarkably like a holy text. Together, the images suggest that Cassius Clay was a man of action and words, a warrior and a prophet. The accompanying story portrayed the boxer as a simple athlete with simple dreams. "I'm going to drive down Walnut Street in a caddy on Derby Day, and all the people will point and say, 'There goes Cassius Clay.' Pretty girls will be there, and I'll smell flowers and feel the nice warm air. Oh, I'm cool then, man, I'm cool. The girls are looking at me, and I'm looking away." This, the author of the piece implied, was Cassius Marcellus Clay, the fresh, innocent savior of boxing. The sum total of his dreams, a tomato-red Cadillac Eldorado, the right woman, and a heavyweight crown. The cover story, however, lacked depth. It laughed at Clay, noting his low IQ and uncomplicated dreams of material success. It bought his magic, seeing only what he chose to reveal. Nowhere in the article is there a mention of the Civil Rights Movement or the Nation of Islam, of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. There is no sense that he had an inner life, or that he wore a disguise as complete as those worn by the Scarlet Pimpernel, Sidney Carton, or Ellison's Invisible Man. Even in the spring of 1963, he was not who people thought he was, or wanted him to be. Chapter 7. Hide Your Cat. Every man should have something he'd die for. A man who won't die for something is not fit to live. Martin Luther King, Jr. Treat me like a man, or kill me. Malcolm X. Since Clay turned professional, he had rarely uttered a single political word. Not once had he complained about the slow pace of desegregation, nor groused to reporters about the escalating racial violence in America. His entire focus was on building a boxing career so that he could earn a title shot and enough money to buy a grand house with two swimming pools, one inside for those rainy days, and a garage full of Cadillacs. All he talked about was boxing, his dreams, and himself. If Clay was a spokesman for any cause, it was his own. Yet, the day after he defeated Doug Jones, he told a black writer in Harlem, "I will become the first heavyweight champion to fight a benefit for the NAACP. Clay's statement was completely disingenuous. He didn't really have any plans to fight for the NAACP. What concerned him more than civil rights was status, his status in the world of boxing and his material worth. In some ways, his attitude about social mobility and materialism reflected the temper of his generation, one that came of age in the affluent society. National advertising campaigns encouraged the millions of young people of his generation to buy rock and roll records, radios, blue jeans, shirts, shoes, soft drinks, cereal, comic books, magazines, movie tickets, and gasoline for cruising in chrome-covered cars. Clay belonged to a youth culture that celebrated pleasure and instant gratification, a distinct demographic that was told that their opinions about everything, from consumer products to social issues, mattered. In an age of growing prosperity, black teenagers who identified with this youth movement believed that freedom and living the good life should be one and the same. Seeing themselves as first-class consumers, many black youths became increasingly alienated when confronted with the reality of their second-class citizenship. When they entered a diner or a department store and were turned away because of the color of their skin, as Clay was in Louisville and Miami, they were told that the good life was not for them. The tension between full participation in the consumer culture and racial exclusion from society cut deep into the dreams of black youths. Yet Clay never expressed the same dissatisfaction that tens of thousands of black activists did when they demonstrated against racism during the sit-ins. When he was growing up in Louisville, there were certain places that he could not go because he was black: restaurants, libraries, public swimming pools, and some downtown movie theaters. The one time he joined a picket in Louisville, a woman dumped hot water on him, and he never returned to the marching lines again. But by March 1963, he was a celebrity, and by his calculation, rich. If for any reason he could not eat somewhere, he could always return to the hotel where he was staying and order anything he wanted from room service, or he could ask his private chef to make him a meal at his home in Miami. Wealth helped him escape discrimination, a luxury most blacks could not afford. Cassius now had more money than most youths ever dreamed of having. He took home $13,500 from selling out Madison Square Garden and earned another $10,000 from the closed-circuit theater ticket sales. By the end of the year, he'd made $81,000, not too far from the president's $100,000 salary. Donating money to the NAACP, therefore, would have certainly benefited him during tax season, a fact that was not lost on him. He frequently complained that the more money he made, the more he paid Uncle Sam. When he declared that he would raise money for the NAACP, he never said anything about giving civil rights lectures or joining any marches in the South. Rather, his financial offer reflected his own strategy of dealing with racism, His success as a boxer earned him economic independence, the kind that Elijah Muhammad promoted. Money, Muhammad preached, gave black men freedom from whites. Most reporters who covered boxing never suspected that Clay had embraced Muhammad's philosophy. Since he rarely talked about race or the civil rights movement, writers assumed that he gave the subject little thought. All they ever heard from him were bombastic proclamations of his own greatness. But in his declarations of preeminence, Alex Poinsett, a black writer for Ebony, heard something more. For when Cassius Clay declares, "I am the greatest," he is not just thinking about boxing, he wrote. Lingering behind those words is the bitter sarcasm of Dick Gregory, the shrill defiance of Miles Davis, and the utter contempt of Malcolm X. Poinsett was circling in on the truth, though he had no idea just how much Clay echoed Malcolm or why he had started to sound like him. Hidden behind Clay's clowning, behind the publicity gimmicks and boyish buffoonery, behind the brashness, Cassius Marcellus Clay is a blast furnace of race pride. His is a race pride that would never mask itself with skin lighteners and processed hair, the way Detroit Red once degraded himself, burning his scalp with a homemade congoline in a quest for straight hair. Clay possessed a pride scorched with memories of a million little burns, like the paper cup he drank root beer from at a New Orleans stand while his white companion, Sports Illustrated's Houston Horn, sipped from a glass. He may not have talked publicly about discrimination, but he projected a more militant, defiant posture, rejecting any notion of racial inferiority. When he boldly shouted, "I am the greatest," he defined his self-worth on his own terms, expressing an emerging attitude of black power. The Pittsburgh Courier's Eric Springer viewed Clay as a new kind of black cultural hero, a symbol of the change that is occurring in our youth, an emblem of racial pride and boundless confidence. In the past, black heroes had been expected to act inconspicuously, humble and deferential to whites. But Clay ushered in a new age when black youths agitated for change, unafraid of testing the limits of white acceptance. Springer compared him to the courageous black teens who endured daily abuse when they entered Central High School in Little Rock, and the brave black college students desegregating Southern universities, like James Meredith at Ole Miss. The moment blacks began embracing Cassius as the personification of youth activism and the struggle for integration, he shed any responsibility for being a leader of his race. "I'm no James Meredith," he told the New York Post's Pete Hamill. "He's got more guts than I'll ever have." Clay had no interest in meeting him or following his example. He stunned readers when he announced that he did not believe in racial integration. "I believe it's human nature to be with your own kind," he declared. "I know what restrooms to use, where to eat, and what to say. I don't want people who don't want me. I don't like people who cause trouble. I'm not going out there to rile up a lot of people." The civil rights movement, he said, was not like a boxing match. "There's no referee in the street." Only a few days after he told a black reporter that he would raise money for the NAACP, and after further consultation with Malcolm, he denounced the organization's goals. "I'm a fighter," he claimed, sounding like he had just left Malcolm's mosque in Harlem. "I believe in the eye-for-an-eye business. I'm no cheek-turner. The NAACP can say, 'Turn the other cheek,' but the NAACP is ignorant." Then he added a final point, ripped from the rich language of his new teacher. "You kill my dog, you better hide your cat." For the first time, Cassius found himself at the center of a political controversy. When he attacked the NAACP, many blacks hoped that this was just another publicity stunt. But Clay was not performing the role of the self-created villain. His comments provoked fear that one of the most famous black athletes in the country had forsaken the ideals of integration and embraced the separatist ideology of the nation, an unsettling thought for those who had built him up as a hero. While most New York newspapers did not cover the controversy due to the labor strike, rumors spread throughout the black press that Cassius had spent time with the black Muslims, though no reporter confirmed his visit with Malcolm after the Jones fight. In Louisville, Clay's white sponsors worried that he had made a grave mistake, alienating much of the country and one of the most respected civil rights organizations in America. Dr. Maurice Rabb, an executive with the NAACP's Louisville branch, contacted the national office, informing them that Cassius had been thoroughly exposed to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. He reported that Clay sneered at the fact that a Jew is the national president of the NAACP. A questionable accusation, given Clay's unsophisticated knowledge about the group's leadership. The Louisville sponsoring group's director, Bill Faversham, arranged for Clay to apologize to Rabb and other local civil rights leaders. Accompanied to the meeting by his brother Rudy and his chauffeur, Cassius denied his verbal assault on the NAACP. But when Rabb invited him to show his support for the organization by purchasing a lifetime membership, he said that the only way that he would join was if they paid him $250,000. Clay left the appointment, promising that he would attend the branch banquet and take a bow if he was in town. After the meeting, the controversy faded from the pages of the black press, though Faversham remained concerned about Clay's increasingly defiant behavior. He told Rabb that if the NAACP wanted to influence the boxer, they might try reaching out to Jackie Robinson or Sugar Ray Robinson, two black athletes Cassius greatly admired. But, he advised, don't bet on him listening to them either, because Cassius makes all decisions concerning Cassius. Faversham suspected that Clay had ties to the black Muslims. Someone must have been advising him and confusing him, he thought, filling his head with dangerous ideas. What he did not know was that Clay was listening to a new mentor who did not trust whites, the NAACP, or Jackie Robinson. This man taught Clay that he was special, not in spite of his skin color, but because he was black. An empowering message that awakened his political consciousness. For the first time in his life, Cassius said, I feel free since I learned the truth about myself and my people. As Clay came into his own, Malcolm hesitated, unsure of his future. Since he had returned from Chicago, all he could think about was the collateral damage from Elijah's affairs. On the streets of Chicago and Harlem, blacks who were not Muslims told him that they had heard about Muhammad's harem. He pretended that he did not know what they were talking about, but it was no use. He could no longer ignore the truth. For years, he had built up the messenger as an honorable man, the moral compass of the nation. Every time he mentioned the Supreme Minister's name, he referred to him as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But Malcolm could no longer call him an honorable leader, knowing how he had disgraced the nation. He hated to admit that Elijah was nothing more than an impostor hiding under a cloak of divinity, because that meant that he, too, was a fraud. He realized that he had no choice. The only way he could deal with the nation's calamity and his own personal crisis was by confronting Elijah. He began by writing Muhammad letters, explaining his actions in Chicago. FBI agents listening to wiretapped lines between Chicago and Phoenix overheard NOI officials say that Malcolm was only seeking, prodding, and prying under the guise of helping. Muhammad assured the NOI officials that Malcolm would never discuss the problems in person. But his younger minister had already decided to fly to Phoenix to confront the issue before it was too late. When he arrived at Muhammad's home, Elijah embraced him like a returning prodigal son. They walked through his backyard patio and settled into chairs near the swimming pool. "Well, son," Elijah asked, "what's on your mind?" Malcolm spoke directly and plainly about what he had heard in Chicago, suggesting a biblical solution that justified Elijah's indiscretions. He explained that he and Wallace had studied the Bible and the Quran for precedents that would justify Elijah's fathering children outside his marriage. If necessary, he said, the ministers could tell the followers that the pregnancies were the fulfillment of prophecy. Elijah smiled and praised his loyal minister. "Son, I'm not surprised. You always have had such a good understanding of prophecy and of spiritual things. You recognize that's what all of this is. Prophecy. I'm David," he declared. When you read about how David took another man's wife, I'm that David. You read books about Noah, who got drunk. That's me. You read about Lot, who went and laid up with his own daughters. I have to fulfill all of those things. After their conversation, Malcolm felt unsatisfied. If Elijah had convinced himself that he was David, Malcolm was less sure that the nation would accept his convenient allegory. Instead of denying his worst fear, Muhammad had confirmed it, leaving Malcolm and the other ministers in the untenable position of having to convince the followers of Elijah's prophecy. Muhammad had instructed him to discreetly inform a few ministers about their conversation, but, he said, under no circumstances should he tell Brother Louis X. Do not tell Louis, he repeated. Malcolm returned to New York, not knowing that Elijah was testing his loyalty. If Malcolm followed his orders, then Elijah would know that he could trust him. But the moment Malcolm attempted to inoculate the nation from the oncoming virus, his enemies in Chicago would charge that he, not Elijah Muhammad, was the untrustworthy one. In Washington, D.C., where Muhammad had recently assigned him to build up the Muslims' presence, Malcolm watched news footage of white police officers unleashing attack dogs on black teenagers who marched for freedom. He admired the courage of Birmingham's youth, but he could not believe that Martin Luther King would allow them to march on the front lines, unable to defend themselves. Teaching nonviolence, he insisted, sedated blacks into passivity. For Malcolm, King's willingness to turn the other cheek made him weak and cowardly, a message he shared with Cassius Clay. A real black man would never let a white man put a hand on him or put their children on the firing line. If a white man turned his dogs on your babies, your women, and your children, then you ought to kill the dogs, whether they've got four legs or two. Despite Malcolm's position on the outskirts of the civil rights leadership, his violent rhetoric shaped the contours of the movement. In the public mind, he became King's foil, a dark and menacing alternative to the Christian philosophy of brotherly love. Malcolm's public criticisms of King's nonviolent philosophy moved him to the center of the national civil rights debate. The fact that reporters interviewed him, seeking his opinion about the Birmingham crisis, gave him further credibility and elevated his national profile. Increasingly, journalists simplified the struggle as a rivalry between two political movements, the nonviolent integrationists and the violent black nationalists. In the aftermath of Birmingham, journalists wrote that the black freedom struggle had reached a crossroads. According to most writers, the struggle could either embrace the moderate leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the NAACP, or turn toward the extremism of Malcolm and the Nation of Islam. In mid-May, after the Ku Klux Klan bombed Birmingham's A.G. Gaston Motel, King's organizing headquarters, rumor spread that Malcolm might visit the battered southern city, but he never did. Elijah Muhammad would not allow it. Instead of traveling to the south, Malcolm criticized Jackie Robinson and Floyd Patterson for going to Birmingham. He claimed that Robinson and Patterson were being used by white liberals to pacify angry blacks. For a boxer who admitted to being scared in the ring, nothing frightened Patterson more than going to Birmingham. When Robinson invited him to speak, he prepared for the worst: jail, beatings, even death. He had told Jackie that he could only afford to stay behind bars for 3 days, but when a television reporter asked him what he would do if the police turned on the hoses or unleashed the dogs, he answered, "I'm not used to standing by like the people in the South, who are much stronger than I am when it comes to this type of thing. I can't stand around and let an animal bite. So," he declared, "I will have to do something." Not every boxer shared Patterson's views. Heavyweight champion Sonny Liston scorned Martin Luther King's nonviolent ideas and the strategies of the NAACP. Several years before, he had called the Freedom Riders stupid, explaining, "That ain't no way to do things. You have to fight for what you get. It's like boxing. No use being in there if you just catch punches, because you're not going to get the decision. Now, if some sucker comes and blows up my house, then someone else's house is going to be blowed up.
and the next time this sucker ain't gonna be in no hurry to go blow up houses.
It was all a matter of fighting back, trading punch for punch. He was not going to participate in any non-violent protests. When a white reporter asked why he was not going to Birmingham, Liston answered, "I ain't got no dog-proof ass."
But Patterson was committed to a cause that Liston refused to join. When he and Robinson arrived in Birmingham on May 13th, they learned that white vigilantes threatened their lives. Protected by a police escort, they toured the ravaged city, visited with ministers and citizens, and spoke at rallies. The next night, they accompanied King to the Sixth Avenue Baptist Church. After Patterson spoke briefly about his admiration for the grassroots activists, Wyatt T. Walker, the executive director of SCLC, introduced Robinson, a man who needed no introduction. As the graying baseball legend rose from the pew and walked pigeon-toed toward the podium, leaning on his cane, the congregation cheered even louder than they had for King. They never forgot all the abuse, the beanballs, the vile epithets, and the death threats that he had endured to prove that blacks belonged in the national pastime. His presence at the church demonstrated that he did not believe that his fight against segregation had ended when he hung up his baseball cleats. When Robinson spoke, the congregation drew strength from a race man, a proud, fearless black man who had stared down Jim Crow without blinking. Malcolm remained unimpressed with Robinson's politics, calling him a traitor for working with white politicians. Over the next year, they sparred through the press. Robinson claimed that he respected Malcolm's intellect, but he insisted that the Nation of Islam's black nationalist philosophy set back the cause of the Negro. Later in the year, Robinson indicted Malcolm for failing to risk his life fighting injustice the way that other activists did in the South. "Whom do you think you are kidding, Malcolm, when you say that Negro leaders ought to be thankful that you were not personally present in Birmingham or Mississippi after racial atrocities had been committed there? The inference seems to be that you would have played some dramatic, avenging role." Robinson did not believe Malcolm would ever have retaliated against white supremacists, because he had never done so before. "I think you would have done exactly what you did after your own Muslim brothers were shot and killed in Los Angeles. You left it to the law to take its course." Apparently, Robinson did not realize how eager some Muslims were to retaliate against those who had crossed them. After the former baseball star wrote a searing editorial denouncing Elijah Muhammad, two Muslim officials brought a copy of the Amsterdam News to the nation's Harlem restaurant. When a gang of Muslims overheard the lieutenants condemning Robinson, they figured that it might be worth their trouble if they hurt him. The only problem was that the Avengers confused the former baseball player with a boxer. They staked out the offices of the Amsterdam News looking for Sugar Ray Robinson. But when he didn't appear, they went to his house. Fortunately for him, he never came home. Eventually, the Muslims drove away, and both Robinsons escaped Allah's vengeance. Even if Malcolm disagreed with Robinson's views, he recognized the power of famous black athletes who engaged the freedom struggle, making Cassius Clay all the more valuable to his political aims. Before the early 1960s, most black professional athletes avoided overt political demonstrations, fearing negative consequences to their careers, while others evaded social action as a personal choice. Most black athletes let their performances on the field do the talking. Yet, in 1963, in the aftermath of the Birmingham crisis, some of the most prominent black athletes became important actors in the struggle, but most of them, like Robinson and Patterson, advocated integration as a racial ideal. So when Clay spoke out against the NAACP, he not only renounced the goals of the civil rights movement, he also rejected the accepted expectations for Negro athletes. The more time he spent with Malcolm, the more he began to sound like him. For now, though, reporters did not question the origins of his evolving political views. But soon, the world would know that Cassius Clay had befriended Malcolm X. As a subject, writer Alex Haley found Malcolm X more fascinating than anyone he had ever interviewed. Everything he did seemed dramatic, and it wasn't that he was trying to be.
Haley later recalled. It was just the nature of him. In the early winter of 1963, before Malcolm flew to Phoenix to confront Elijah, he met Haley at the Muslims' Harlem Luncheonette for a lengthy interview, which was later published in Playboy. Malcolm, as was his custom, sat facing the door, sipping coffee, while his aides occasionally whispered messages in his ear. The interview covered Malcolm's redemption story and the black Muslims' ideological beliefs. When Haley asked him if he regretted his comments about the plane crash that killed 120 white Atlantans, he replied, "Sir, as I see the law of justice, it says, as you sow, so shall you reap. The white man has reveled as the rope snapped black man's necks. He has reveled around the lynching fire. It's only right for the black man's true God, Allah, to defend us, and for us to be joyous, because our God manifests his ability to inflict pain on our enemy." Malcolm knew that some of his answers would frighten people. He didn't trust that Haley or the editors at Playboy would publish his comments verbatim, as they had agreed, though the editors kept their word. He also knew that whatever he said would be read by Elijah and other officials in the nation, so when Haley suggested that he was the real brains and power of the movement, he immediately corrected him. "Sir, it's heresy to imply that I am in any way whatever even equal to Mr. Muhammad. No man on earth today is his equal." He insisted that no one, including himself, was worthy of replacing the messenger. His answer must have pleased Muhammad. In May, after the magazine appeared on newsstands, Haley pondered something that Malcolm had said to him. "You wouldn't believe my past." Perhaps, he thought, the minister would talk more about his life, his evolution, how Malcolm Little became Malcolm X. When the writer asked him if he would consent to an autobiography, he looked stunned. "It was one of the few times I have ever seen him uncertain," Haley later recalled. Malcolm told him that he would need to think about the offer. After considering it, Malcolm told Haley that he would agree on two conditions. First, every penny of his royalties would go directly to the NOI. Second, Elijah Muhammad must approve the project. When Haley visited Muhammad in Phoenix, he explained that the book would help spread his message. Nodding, Elijah answered, "Allah approves." After Haley returned to New York City, he and Malcolm signed a contract with Doubleday, which included a $20,000 advance for them to split equally. After planning their next meeting, Malcolm handed him a handwritten dedication. "This book I dedicate to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who found me here in America, in the muck and mire of the filthiest civilization and society on this earth, and pulled me out, cleaned me up, and stood me on my feet, and made me the man that I am today." As promised, Haley filed away the dedication, oblivious of how much Malcolm's life would change by the time he finished the manuscript. On Friday, June 14, 1963, an all-white Los Angeles jury rendered its decision in the Stokes case. It convicted 9 of 13 black Muslim defendants, finding them guilty of assaulting police officers during the raid on the West Coast Mosque. 2 of the Muslims were acquitted, and the jury could not reach unanimous verdicts on 2 others. 4 of the convicted men received prison sentences ranging from 1 to 5 years, 1 served time in the county jail, and the others received probation. 10 days later, WNDT in New York televised The Negro and the American Promise, a series of interviews Dr. Kenneth Clark conducted with Malcolm, King, and James Baldwin. Clark, a prominent psychology professor at City College in New York, taped the interviews separately and focused his questions on the future of the black man. Still carrying the burden of Birmingham on his shoulders, King looked exhausted on camera, as if he had just returned from a funeral. In a quiet, gentle voice, he recalled his experience in jail, unwavering in his commitment to nonviolence. Malcolm, angered by the Stokes ruling, spoke forcefully and bitterly, repeating his criticisms of King. James Baldwin sympathized with King, but feared that America's blacks were exasperated with his message. Sitting cross-legged, smoking a cigarette, the slight, dark splinter of a man with bulbous eyes spoke in contemplative, almost theatrical tones. Wearily, he vented, "You can only survive so many beatings, so much humiliation, so much despair, so many broken promises, before something gives." He warned that although King possessed great moral authority in the South, his message did not resonate with blacks in northern cities. "Poor Martin has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience," he said. "But Martin has reached the end of his rope." Baldwin's comments echoed the sentiments of his book, The Fire Next Time, a searing indictment of America's history of racism. Writing in labyrinthine sentences, he fiercely articulated the anger and alienation of black America. "The so-called American Negro," he wrote, "remains trapped, disinherited, and despised in a nation that has kept him in bondage for nearly 400 years and is still unable to recognize him as a human being." His message carried overtones of Malcolm's speeches and Elijah Muhammad's sermons. In the second of the book's two essays, Baldwin recounted his Sunday afternoon visit with Elijah at the Chicago mansion in the summer of 1962. Before his meeting with the black Muslims, many Americans thought of Baldwin as an integrationist, though he never embraced such a label. In the age of television, he emerged as a celebrity writer turned activist, the literary voice of the black experience, a poet of the blues. At the mansion, Baldwin sat nervously at a large dining table for nearly 30 minutes, chatting with Elijah's aides while they waited for him to arrive. When Muhammad entered the room, everyone rose from the table. Something came into the room with him. His disciples' joy at seeing him. His joy at seeing them, Baldwin wrote. Studying Muhammad, Baldwin recognized that the central quality in Elijah's face is pain, and his smile is a witness to it. Pain so old and deep that it becomes personal and particular only when he smiles. That agony etched onto his face derived from the haunted memories of his boyhood, growing up with 11 siblings in a poor family of sharecroppers in rural Georgia, hearing frightening stories about slave drivers abusing his grandparents, and seeing a bloodied black teenager dangling from a tree limb when he was just 10 years old. As Elijah lectured on American history and the affliction of blacks at the hands of whites, Baldwin realized that he couldn't refute him. When Kenneth Clark asked him about the appeal of the nation, he admitted, "When Malcolm talks, or the Muslim ministers talk, they articulate for all the Negro people who hear them their suffering, the suffering which has been in this country so long denied. That's Malcolm's great authority over any of his audiences." In Baldwin's view, what made Malcolm so potent politically, so sinister, was that when he spoke, he told black people the brutal truth. Malcolm made them confront their fears about whites, about the source of their powerlessness. Without acknowledging their past, he said, they could never sustain meaningful change. When he talked about the solution to ending their suffering, black people believed him, because they had lived his words. For the first time, Baldwin declared, America had legitimate reason to fear the black Muslims. If whites failed to eradicate the conditions that created the nation, if they failed to cleanse the country of hatred, then America might not survive. "A bill is coming," he warned, "that I fear America is not prepared to pay."
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for the first audio segment. We'll be on Chapter 8, very beginning of Chapter 8, The Great Pretender. Folks have commentary they would like to share on what we've heard thus far, feel free to chime in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to to participate. Folks who would like to use the Vote line, if you don't have a phone or if you don't want to use your phone to dial in and share your thoughts, it's linked for the free Vote line. It's linked at the Black Talk Radio Network. The address, if you need it, is tinyTiny.cc/oneRace. That is the number one. Address again, tinyTiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you enter that address, it will take you to the page. Look on the left side, bottom left corner, you'll see the link. It says free Vote line. Click that. It will open a tiny window on your screen. When you see the window, top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which, again, is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use nickname, real name. You can make up a name, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt to press the number 1, and I can add you to the line. Right on. We will nab folks who dialed in who have a hand up with us thus far. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share your thoughts.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to other callers and listeners. I've been following along, although I hadn't been here on Friday. But first, I'd like to say that just the title of the book, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, seems like an act of racism because, you know, what is Blood Brothers? And then the fact that it was a fatal friendship, you know, it's implying that Muhammad Ali did not protect Malcolm X. And if you knew anything about Malcolm X and how fearless he was, it would be hard to imagine him trying to hide behind a celebrity for protection from a group that he was a part of. That's just my opinion. I may be wrong. But when, you know, they write about Muhammad Ali now, you know, he's deceased. But, you know, they talk about how he was the greatest and how much they loved him. But during the time, during his heyday, whites despised him. They hated him. It was almost like it was a black against white. And Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay represented blacks, and whites did not like his boisterous attitude or his loud mouth. You know, and the book implies that he was a clown and he was practiced buffoonery. But at the same time, you can see that Cassius Clay and develop into Muhammad Ali was genius in promoting himself and in his boxing style. And I did not like the way that the book just kind of played Floyd Patterson off, because Floyd Patterson was a great boxing champ in his own right. He went to the Olympics, I believe, in 1952. And he, you know, boxed his way up. I think he became the youngest light heavyweight champion. And, you know, he paid his dues, and, you know, they just kind of just went over him a little bit, like he, you know, was too meek or whatever. And saying that he gained the title after Marciano retired. Sure, Marciano retired, but the title was up for grabs, and he had to fight Archie Moore for that. And at that time, back in 56, Archie Moore wasn't what they were trying to call him, fat and out of shape and all that. He was somebody to be reckoned with himself. I think the firefighter from Florida gave us some insight on that. But it was saying, you know, that Cassius Clay grew up in Louisville and that he couldn't go to certain places. And I guess his activities as far as counter-racism was a sit-in, and he joined in on a picket, and a woman dumped some hot water on him, and he never returned to the marching lines again. You know, I assume that a lot of this stuff is based on facts. I see the footnote here. But, you know, it's just the context and the way that it's presented. You know, it's not presenting him in a good light. Saying that his success as a boxer earned him economic independence, the kind that Elijah Muhammad promoted. Money, Muhammad preached, gave black men freedom from whites. You know, I think that the way that this is worded, you know, it could be debatable on whether or not some of this was said, but I think the inference is, you know, to try to downplay the Nation of Islam and also Muhammad Ali and also Malcolm X. The FBI agents were listening, wiretaps on the Nation of Islam, and then their interpretation of what they heard could be totally different from what was actually said. And then, according to the Constitution, they were violating citizens' rights by wiretapping and running these surveillance on their lives. When Wallace Muhammad went to prison for draft avoidance, you know, he had a what you call a religious deferment or an exemption. You know, if it had been carried out legally, you know, he may have served time, but then again, that was wrong. Both violations, blatant violations of constitutional rights. And then they show the Nation of Islam like bumbling idiots when they were going to exact revenge upon Jackie Robinson. They staked out Sugar Ray Robinson instead, and it looks like Sugar Ray Robinson would have gotten a beating that they were trying to give Jackie Robinson. You know, it's like they were just clowns or dummies, and they eventually drove away. And, you know, it's I'll mute my line, but I see a lot of blatant acts of racism in this writing, and like I say, even. And then, oh, one last thing. Friday, June the 14th, 1963, all-white jury rendered the Stokes case a decision on that. Now, where the police shot, you know, these black Muslims in the back, mostly, killed Stokes, none of the policemen were even indicted. They said that the Muslims, nine of the 13 black Muslim defendants, finding them guilty of assaulting police officers during the raid on the West Coast Mosque. Two of the Muslims was acquitted, and the jury could not reach a unanimous verdict on two others. Four of the convicted men received prison sentences ranging from 1 to 5 years, one serving time in county jail and the others receiving probation. In a system of white supremacy, everything is just in reverse. They assaulted the Muslim men, shot them in the back. None of them were indicted. The black men were indicted and prosecuted. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
For sure. I'll use it next week. One of the co-authors, Johnny Smith, suspected racist, he did an interview on Book TV for this book earlier this year, and he explained the title for the book. He elaborated in some detail. I will play that next week. You can hear his explanation for why they chose this as the title of the book, Blood Brothers. Other folks have commentary they would like to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all. Really good job breaking it down. I thought by Mr. Demery. I'm keeping a lot of the same things with the writer. I think even took a little jab in there when he was talking about the black Muslims going after Jackie Robinson and ending up going after Sugar Ray Robinson instead or whatever. You know, if he made a little Allah willing, you know, little comment that wasn't necessary, you know, what was the point of putting that in there at all? You know, sort of like taking a shot at, their deity. You know, I'm not a big fan of Jackie Robinson, but, that would have been, terrible had they, beat up a athlete because he said something in the press. You know, that's just, horrible. As for, it seems like with the name change, right now it's still Cassius Clay. He's not quite yet Muhammad Ali. You know, he's still not taking on that ideal. I think it's time to get in there. And I think with his name change, I think his ideals change, and you really got a chance to hear it later on. But right now they are painting the picture. And, I never saw Muhammad Ali fight. You know, that's way before my time. But, he was just, the typical black guy with every stereotype going, a bunch of girls, a garage full of Cadillacs, I'm just not the Muhammad Ali that I know, it's very, I don't know if he's being honest or not, because I wasn't there, but just interesting hearing that. And, I think that there's a lot of, the way he's writing this whole part about the rift inside the nation of Islam, I think it's being written in a way that where it's little subtle ways that it's look at these niggas type of, the way it's written, of course they can't do anything right, let me just break down what happened and this is where they failed and, look at them and this one setting this one up and, I know that's probably what happened. It's just the way it's being written. It's coming from, you can tell it's not a black author that's writing that part. Can I mute my line, please?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Mr. Demery 4, right on the mark as far as being accurate, and I agree with him. He did a good job of breaking down because I've been sitting around just thinking about this book and to get a more accurate understanding of what these two white people were doing in terms of with the written word and this history. And he brought it more to focus with me, Mr. Demery Forward, by saying, but in my mind, they are pretty consistent at pointing at the flaws. Now, they may be accurate from a historical standpoint, but for a white person under the global system of racism and white supremacy to point at the flaws of non-white people's inability to figure out and neutralize racism and white supremacy and replace it with a system of justice is like, you cripple somebody and then in their means to try to heal themselves, you pick at them, you chastise them. And that's basically what what I'm getting out of this. The information, some of what is interesting about the book is some of the information that you may not have known. They have little tidbits in there so far. To give you some reference on what I'm talking about, the different reports on how Sonny Liston felt about the particular strategy to end the system of racist white supremacy, and he had an opinion to it, and once again, I would say only VGQ to Floyd Patterson. Floyd Patterson grew up in Harlem under the worst conditions that was put in place directly by the global system of racist white supremacy. And then you're going to criticize, you're going to make a critique on him, on what he said and what he's not. That should not even be done by another non-white black person. Back then and today, the question should be with a non-white black person, what am I doing? What am I attempting to do? As far as that concerned, a white person should have their mouth closed. As far as about that, or which you know they're not, by opening their mouths and doing what they're doing, they are practicing racism, white supremacy, in my opinion. Muhammad Ali, at that time known as Cassius Clay, the guy was only about maybe 20 years old. When he won the title, he was 22 years old. He just missed from breaking Floyd Patterson's record of being the youngest heavyweight champion in the history of boxing. Floyd Patterson was 21 years old, so he just missed. He just kind of like missed it because I believe Muhammad Ali's birthday is in January. I could be wrong about that. At that particular point in time, because he was, and I think I mentioned it the last week, because he was sponsored by some very wealthy, powerful white males, he didn't have to go through the advent like Archie Moore, who had to. Archie Moore was in his mid-30s before he even had a chance to fight for the light heavyweight title. He didn't have to go through that. Also, what happens with boxing is still another reason why it's not really a sport as far as the background ingredients of boxing, the sport, the politics of the sport itself. It's controlled by criminals, literally by criminals, and if you didn't have any type of backing, you would have to do all kinds of treacherous stuff. To whereas you fought somebody that was overwhelmingly better than you in terms of experience, that sort of thing, or if you was really that good, like I mentioned about Archie Moore, they were not going to allow you to fight for the title. Joe Louis had to give his salary for the rest of his boxing career to a white male who he knocked out for the heavyweight title of the world. That was a part of the contract for him to even fight for the title. That's how crooked the sport of boxing was. But like I said, Muhammad Ali was able to avoid that, and in turn, with all of those white backers and Angelo Dundee, they kind of like fixed his trick. You know, fighting the right type of people, although Doug Jones, I believe it was his name, was very dangerous at that point, because you can see all of those fights that they're talking about in the book. You can see all of those fights on YouTube if you care to. And when he hit Cassius, he was in real trouble. But his style was. I'm old enough to have seen him on fights in his prime, to whereas he was the fastest person of that size. Although when he was in the Olympics, he was only about 170 pounds, and so in the time that it took for him to get up weight, you know, to be around 205, 210, I believe he fought for the title at 210. You know, they gave him these particular type of fights. But he was very quick, so, and he was smart enough to know how to, once he got in trouble, that he can manage the problems until he can get stronger. So those are some of the ideals about his athletic ability. And I've been around athletes all my life, and he fits right in the mold of some of the greatest athletes of all time as far as his abilities in that ring. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, to all the callers, Mr. Demery, firefighter in Florida, and Thomas in New York, and all the other callers and listeners. I think all of the brothers really pointed out some serious stuff with the racism, because I've been peeping it too. And I think, again, I must compliment Mr. Demery as well. He did an exceptional job as far as the way that he did break everything down. There's a couple things I did want to touch on. On page 102, the authors write, the cover story, however, lacked depth. It laughed at Clay, noting his low IQ and uncomplicated dreams of material success. It brought his magic, seeing only what he chose to reveal. Nowhere in the article is there a mention of the Civil Rights Movement or the Nation of Islam, of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. There is no sense that he had an inner life or that he wore a disguise as complete as those worn by the Scarlet Pimpernel, Sidney Carton, or Ellison's Invisible Man. Even in the spring of 1963, he was not who people thought he was or wanted him to be. And this was, I think, a really poignant act of racism practiced by the authors, because they're basically practically calling him criminally deceptive. And they're doing it in such a clandestine way that if you're not reading this with codified understanding, it will fly over your head and potentially put ideas in your head as to the type of person he is. And that's what I think they're actually brilliant at, is this clandestine form of speak. Now, the one thing I will say about having a white author reading, a white person reading the book, is the tone that he uses is a white supremacist tone. So it helps a lot of this racism to stand out. Like when Thomas was talking about the jabs he was taking at the Nation of Islam, the tone of which the author is reading the book, and him being a white man, there is a white supremacist undertone to his speak, which I think actually makes this really good that he's a white man reading the book rather than a black person who might read it in a way, I guess I would say a more reverent way for the people that they're speaking of. And you might lose some of that that racism, because it comes off in the vocal inflection of the person who's narrating the book. Also, there was a section on page 105 where they write, when he declared that he would raise money for the NAACP, he never said anything about giving civil rights lectures or joining any marches in the South. Rather, his financial offer reflected his own strategy of dealing with racism. His success as a boxer earned him economic independence, the kind that Elijah Muhammad promoted. Money, Muhammad preached, gave black men freedom from whites. Now, if that's really true, then that just shows, in my opinion, a lack of understanding of the system of white supremacy. For any black person to think that money's going to give you freedom from whites, that's something that even I grew up hearing. When I was in the music business, and I it was something that I thought was true at that time. I was very young, but as I got older, you start to understand how this really works. And I think I'm assuming he must be very young at this time, because I'm pretty sure as he got older, he understood that money would not help him escape white supremacy at all. I found this a real poignant act of white supremacy by the authors. This was a couple paragraphs down on the same page 105. Poinsett was circling in on the truth, though he had no idea just how much Clay echoed Malcolm or why he started to sound like him. Hidden in Clay's clowning, behind the publicity gimmicks and boyish buffoonery, behind the brashness, Cassius Marcellus Clay is a blast furnace of race pride. His race pride that would never mask itself with skin lighteners and processed hair, the way Detroit Red once degraded himself, burning his scalp with a homemade congoline in the quest for straight hair. And I found that to be just blatantly disrespectful. I don't know where they get off even thinking that they could, you know, utter anything about Malcolm X in a derogatory, even if they're speaking about his past life, simply because white people are the reason he had to live as Detroit Red in the first place. White people are the reason behind he thought it was okay to actually conk his hair and do those self-destructive things, and white people facilitated his self-destruction. So I just find that to be one of the most disgusting, nauseating acts of white supremacy I've seen in a very long time, and it really kind of set me off. when they wrote that and had the nerve to write that, and the way that it was even spoken by the author helped it to stand out for me in the reading of the text. In the paragraph beneath that, they say Clay possessed a pride scorched with the memories of a million little burns, like the paper cup he drank root beer from at a New Orleans stand, while his white companion, Sports Illustrated Preston Horn, sipped from a glass. He may not have talked publicly about discrimination, but he projected a more militant, defiant posture, rejecting any notion of racial inferiority. When he boldly shouted, "I am the greatest," he defined his self-worth on his own terms, expressing an emerging attitude of black power. And I just found that when they said that, it just made me think of how whites analyze everything and how they could actually equate him expressing an emerging attitude of black power with him stating that he's the greatest. So it really goes to show how white people really study us, and they really do a lot of psychoanalyzing in a way that we're not always aware. I found it really also sad, the anti-blackness between all of these different powerful black people that was expressed, as far as Malcolm and Martin and Malcolm and Jackie Robinson, and just all of this infighting when we're all trying to fight for the same thing. And I feel that even in when they were expressing that, they were exacerbating these rifts in ideology between these people, which will again give you this understanding or this idea that all we do is fight amongst ourselves, and that there was no understanding amongst these people when, you know, Minister Malcolm and Dr. Martin Luther King actually were able to meet and heal their rift and actually came to a consensus and were on the same page about moving forward with taking this country, as well as the European countries, to the United Nations for human rights violations against African people. And I just find this to be something that they play up. And again, through the reading of this white author, it helps to exacerbate, in my mind, the white supremacy that's being practiced by these white people. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. Other folks, if you have commentary, let us not wait till the last moment. If you have anything you want to get in, we have about 20 minutes before we get to the second audio segment, Chapter 8. Before I share any thoughts, one of our listeners is reading a different bio on Muhammad Ali, The Greatest, My Own Story by Muhammad Ali. It also has a white co-author. I think many, if not most, of the bios written on Muhammad Ali have a white ghostwriter or a white author. The racist hand is going to be involved some way, shape, form. But he shared a segment last week that I read from the book, where he talked about making the statement disparaging the continent of Africa and then feeling bad about it, and seeing how whites were able to manipulate that statement that he made in the press during the Olympics, much like what you all have pointed out with the white authors of this book this week. The segment he shared is from Chapter 6, The Induction. It reads, "Give me your papers," the next doctor snaps, "as I move into this stall." He's fidgeting and he speaks with a strong southern drawl. "Take off your shorts, all the way down." He adjusts his glasses and appraises me like I'm a bull that came into the herd. Welsing moment. "Up closer," he snorts, leaning down to examine my penis. Of all the doctors I face, he is the most hateful. He's checking for venereal disease or a hernia, an orderly tells me. The doctor jabs his hand into my testicles. He feels around with his thumb until he finds the spot he's looking for and tells me to cough. "Again," he says. "So you don't want to go and fight for your country." His hand is tight on my testicles, and I say nothing. A chill creeps over my whole body, and I think of the days when castrations and lynchings were common in the South. Chapter 6, The Induction, The Greatest, My Own Story by Muhammad Ali. Folks are looking for extra reading on the subject matter. Moving forward, back to the book we're reading at hand, Blood Brothers. There's an audio segment from Bill Roden, author of $40 Million Slave, who has written, spoken quite a bit on Muhammad Ali over the past few decades, but certainly over the past few months since Ali's transition. And one of the
more poignant points that he made was that, and he was calling out names and everything, people like Dave Zirinen, who has written quite a bit on racism in sports. He's been a guest on this program. He was, in fact, on Democracy Now! Today talking about the Olympics in Rio. He was saying white people like Dave Zirin have come out and written a lot of material on Muhammad Ali and talking about how great he is and contributed to this revisionist effort that, oh, yes, we love him and he's, you know, one of the greatest Americans and everything that he did, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, a lot of these whites, they were around in the 1960s, and they certainly did not love him then. And even if they did, what were they doing? What did you do to help this Negro that you have so much affinity for, particularly the years where he was suspended and struggling and didn't have money to take care of himself, his family, his children? What were you doing? What were you willing to put on the line to help him and any other black people during that time period? It's easy to come out after he can no longer speak and tell you about racism, white supremacy, and be out there with his quips and attacks on the system of racism as he did for many, many years. It's easy to do that once he's in his rocking chair, and particularly now that he's transitioned. It's easy to do that now if you're a white person, and you can have all your facts and information can be totally correct. But as a white person, suspected racist, that's not what I'm interested in, hearing you come and be the custodian of record and talking about these black people and their struggles and what they endured as victims of racism. That's not what I'm interested in hearing from you. It's just a really great commentary. I'm kind of saving that for the end of the book. That'll be our finishing intro as we ride out. But we got a ways to go before we get there. Some of even what you all have said, I don't want to say dilemma, but this is something I confront on a regular basis, reading material, having white guests on the program where they are writing about racism, white supremacy, which they do all the time. Again, this notion that white people are ignorant about racism, nothing could be further from the truth. This book is well footnoted, as are most of the white books from guests that we have on this program or white authors that we've done in our book club. These folks are not ignorant about racism or the time period that they're talking about. It's well footnoted. If you check the reference section, as Roz and some of the other callers have stated, they make it their business to study that grain of sand, every little detail, in terms of extracting more information about how they are going to further refine, maintain white power. But it is challenging going through, picking out information. I'm sure people have learned some things that they didn't know going through, but then also picking out the racism where these white authors and even the white narrator and how this narrative is constructed. It can be laborsome doing both at the same time. Some of the things that I picked out, as I said before, that was, I think, even some of the listeners who knew about this book before we started it, and saying that they thought it would be constructive and kind of pointing out anti-blackness and how that's something that we really need to watch. I think we talked about that last week when Muhammad, or he was Cassius Clay at the time, was doing the name calling of Sonny Liston, where he starts off this week where he's going to fight Mr. Jones, and he's calling him names as well and how ugly he is and that sort of thing. Really something I think we should all kind of bear in mind in the system. We really want to try and work away from that. And again, Muhammad Ali did apologize for a lot of this, particularly his name calling of Joe Frazier after some years. Some of the other things, see, from chapter 6, the portion where they talk about Mr. Bodini, Drew Bundini Brown, who is one of the cornermen for Muhammad Ali throughout his career. After Muhammad Ali sells out the Garden for his fight against Jones, and they're saying, wow, the Garden, Madison Square Garden in New York, hasn't been sold out in forever, and the sport's been in decline, and Muhammad Ali is making it happen. He comes in and is like, you know, you all get busy, and he's ordering white people around, you know, shine his shoes and wash his socks and get it together. I mean, he's selling out the Garden. It reminded me of one of our previous guests on the program, John Hoberman. He wrote Darwin's Athletes. He is also a white person who has written about sports and racism and other topics in racism, where one of the main themes of that book is that for a long period of time, whites would not allow someone like Muhammad Ali or Jack Johnson to be heavyweight champion in the system of white power. But then they can switch it and say, okay, we're still going to have our system, but we will allow you niggers to box. maybe a few of you. And we'll still abuse you and mistreat you, but we will, you know, enjoy recreational activity with you all in the ring and rooting and hoping that you fail all the way along, that the system of white supremacy can and certainly now does accommodate a certain amount of Negro presence, even put it in quotes, Negro success in athletic endeavors, particularly if they're going to be the ones who are the primary economic beneficiaries, which is always, always, always the case. I think you all were even pointing that out with Michael Jordan last week. The amount of money that he makes pales in comparison to what Phil Knight and the whites at Nike et al. Make from him. Let's see. The passage... Also, the passage about where he was on the protest line, I thought that was important. Again, I think this notion, Muhammad Ali, where says he one time he joined a picket line in Louisville when a woman dumped hot water on him. For me, I think frequently when we think about racism, white supremacy, it is white men who are the aggressors, who are the soldiers doing this. Very important to remember that this is an equal partnership, white men, white women. I'm even reminded of Elizabeth Eckford, since they did mention the Little Rock Nine and being hounded by this white woman, Hazel. We did Elizabeth and Hazel way back when in the book club as well, where she was one of the primary antagonists going after these black children and bullying them. Very important to keep that in mind as well, I think. Let's see, moving forward, when he talks about Muhammad Ali making quite a bit of money for this period of time, close to what the president's salary was, and he says Muhammad Ali was, or at the time Cassius Clay, he was going to donate money to the NAACP, but this was more for him to get some tax breaks, and not so much because he was, you know, altruistically interested in some sort of activist work or allegiance with the NAACP. I thought that was... just the way it was presented, I thought, could have been a major act of racism, white supremacy on the part of the authors, and kind of taking, as you all have stated, kind of a subtle jab at his efforts. It is footnoted here, this portion of the paragraph, where he's talking about him doing this. I also thought it was pretty interesting when they talk about the remarks that Muhammad Ali made disparaging the NAACP, and he didn't agree with their strategy, and I want to get the exact passage here. I guess it's a little bit further. I'll get to it when I come to it. Some of the things in between before he gets to his disparaging comments about the NAACP, I thought it was really important when he talks about Cassius Clay, his admiration for James Meredith and some of the other actors, activists at that time. I, too, huge fan of James Meredith. I've mentioned him before on the program. Dick Gregory got mentioned as well, one of our previous guests on the broadcast. The NAACP passage. It's right below his comments about James Meredith and the admiration that he had for him, where he says he told a black reporter that he would raise money for the NAACP, and after further consultation with Malcolm, he denounced the organization's goals. I'm a fighter, he claimed, sounding like he had just left Malcolm's mosque in Harlem. I believe in the eye for an eye business. I'm no cheek turner. The NAACP can say turn the other cheek, but the NAACP is ignorant. Then he added a final point ripped from the rich language of his new teacher, you kill my dog, you better watch your cat, where he comes right a paragraph after that. He says, in Louisville, Clay's white sponsors worried that he had made a grave mistake, alienating much of the country and one of the most respected civil rights organizations in America. Dr. Maurice Rabb, an executive with NAACP's Louisville branch, contacted the national office informing them that Cassius had been thoroughly exposed to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. He reported that Clay sneered at the fact that a Jew is the national president of the NAACP, a questionable accusation given Clay's unsophisticated knowledge about the group's leadership. I thought that last sentence in particular very important, because now they have in quotes that Clay sneered at the fact that a Jew is the national president of the NAACP. That's in quotes. The rest of it is not. So this is the author's direct language, where they say a questionable accusation given Clay's unsophisticated knowledge about the group's leadership. I don't know what qualifies them to judge his knowledge as being unsophisticated. Sounds like he's just some uncouth, poorly educated Negro talking about this grand organization. And how dare you say that a white person is in charge, where many other black people said the same thing, who were contemporaries of Cassius Clay at this time, Malcolm X being one, who said the exact same thing. And I don't think you could exactly say that they made an unsophisticated critique or had unsophisticated knowledge about the NAACP. I think if you check, there is a lot of validity to what he's saying in terms of who is managing, manipulating the NAACP. I'm not disparaging black people who were involved with that organization, past, present, future, but I do think that there is verifiable evidence that whites have had their hand controlling, whether it's financially, directly, indirectly, what happens with that group and many of the other organizations that have been designed to deal with racism, white supremacy. I thought that paragraph was really important for many reasons. And then even after that, where they set up this meeting where he's supposed to apologize for offending. And this is another one where I point out the problem is not, quote unquote, someone being a Jew or Jewish. I suspect that Mr. Ra or Dr. Rab is a racist. The problem is not that he identifies as being a Jew or Jewish. The problem is that I suspect this is a race soldier, and they just try and throw that confusion in, and then they can say that you're being an anti-Semite or, you know, whatever else. But they set up this meeting after that where he's supposed to apologize for saying this and you know, airing your unsophisticated knowledge and slander of Dr. Rab and the NAACP. And he goes in and says that he declines to join, or says he'll join if they pay him $250,000, which I guess they did not do. That was fascinating, and I just thought great from a very young Cassius Clay. That was great. Really appreciated that. That was something that I did not know with all this exchange. Let's see. The white people being concerned, I think that had been talked about last week, even in reference with Sonny Liston. Whites having control over these individuals, much like today. We're going to make a lot more money off of these athletes than they're going to make. So, hey, we can control and make sure that the police don't nigger knock our particular fighter or whatever the person is, actor, whatever they're doing to make us some coins or whatever we want them to do to get things done. And we have a vested interest in making sure that they don't get exposed to any radical material that might mess up their thinking and make them a little bit more difficult for us to control and profit from. They emphasized again this week the FBI agents listening, wiretapping, all of these conversations. In my opinion, that should be foregrounded as opposed to inserting their snickers and laughing at the Nation of Islam and their faith, and they think it's laughable or jokey that they, you know, think these spaceships are going to come or what have you, or the anti-blackness, really emphasizing and foregrounding the amount of government-sanctioned surveillance that all of these individuals were subjected to, the illegality of this, the constitutional violations, and why this was being done, and not just to these folks, but this was so widespread, as we've talked about on the program before. Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, Racial Matters, great information about COINTELPRO, also written by a white man. I did want to say one point to, I guess I'll get this in quick before we get to, if anybody has anything quick they want to get in. I think Roz brought up the point last week where he was saying that when the authors, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, when they said they categorized Minister Malcolm's speech when he was talking about the abuse that black people were facing at the hands of the police, and he classified it as rhetoric when he said that it was like black people were in concentration camps and what was happening to them, and he classified it as rhetoric when he was, you know, talking about we're not just going to take this as Muslims. And this week, when they're listening to Jackie Robinson, and Jackie Robinson says that, you know, hey, I think you're just talking wolf tickets, as they say, because I don't think if you had been in Alabama or some of these other spots where black people were being terrorized, I don't think you would have fought back, because Nation of Islam members have been brutalized by police before, and you didn't retaliate then. You said, let's be cool, let's follow the course of the law. I think that's exactly what you would have done, same thing that you did in Los Angeles. And I thought Jackie Robinson is accurate. Unless I am in error, he's telling the truth. And if that is the case, wouldn't it be accurate to classify what Malcolm X is saying as rhetoric? If he's talking all of this, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, we're not like these, you know, NAACP members that are about nonviolence, and these Christians, that's not us. In the Nation of Islam, we're going to retaliate. And that was not what Elijah Muhammad wanted to do. That was not what he ended up going out and telling people to do, even though personally he might have differed with that stance. That's not what he went out and said. Wouldn't that make it accurate to describe it as rhetoric since it's not being followed through? Yeah. Question. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? And then if folks want to respond to that question or anything else they want to make sure they get in. Oh, my last thing I'll get in. Then folks want to quickly respond to that question before we get to the second audio. The portion at the bottom of Chapter 7, which says before the early 1960s, most black professional athletes avoided overt political demonstrations fearing negative consequences to their careers, while others evaded social action as a personal choice. I thought that was really important, kind of an obscure segment in all of this. I think a lot of times people come out and castigate black athletes of this generation and say, man, they should be doing more. I've heard this directed at Venus and Serena Williams and LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, anybody, and say, you know, they should be doing more. They should be talking about racism. They're a disgrace to the legacy of people like Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and folks who stood up and were willing to sacrifice so much. And wait a minute, not every black athlete of that time period was doing that. It's almost the same kind of thing where I hear where people castigate people from right now and saying that black people in general are not focused, they're not doing anything about racism like people in the 60s. Most black people in general in the 60s were not involved in the protests, the freedom rides, or whatever the case may be. That was a small group of black people that were out and doing that. Most black people were not engaged in that activity. That was something that I thought was significant, even in its obscurity. Quick comments. We are getting ready to move to the next audio segment, but quick comment either to the portion about the quoting, classifying what Minister Malcolm said as rhetoric. What Jackie Robinson said, is that accurate? And or anything else folks want to make sure they get in concisely? We have about 3 minutes before we get to the second audio segment.
Yes. What was the question that you was asking?
I think last week, Roz, I think submitted, and he can set me straight if I'm in error, but I think I'm paraphrasing. He said that he thought the white authors might have been practicing racism by classifying some of Malcolm X's statements as rhetoric when he was saying that black people were basically subjected to concentration camps by the police terrorism that was being practiced against them. And we're not like these Christians and other folks who are into nonviolence. We fight back. Jackie Robinson, this week we heard, said, hey, I don't believe you. You did not do that when Stokes and the other NOI members were attacked by the police. You all didn't fight back. That's not what you said. You said, we're going to let the law handle it. We're going to be cool. Since that was what happened, isn't it accurate to say that that is rhetoric, since you're saying this, but you are not, in fact, giving a stance that, yes, we're going out to attack the LAPD or anybody else who does something to Muslims?
Well, I don't know if I can answer it directly, but it sounds like with if white people have anything to do with it, it sounds like something prime that they would kind of like pit the two non-white people against one another. That's what it sounds like a whole lot. I did know that there was some disagreement between the two in political thought over through the media. From that standpoint, you heard about it in the documentary that was on Jackie Robinson, and there's quite a bit of video or taped disagreement, primarily I've heard from Jackie Robinson, primarily, more so than Malcolm X, because Malcolm X, of course, was part of the generation that looked up to Jackie Robinson. You know, I mean, Jackie Robinson was a national athletic and political star while Malcolm was in prison. You know, so and you could almost even hear in his speeches, anytime he mentioned Jackie Robinson, it was kind of like in a admiration type of thought process that he had for them. But what I was going to
hang on 1 second
to add on.
Hurry up and get to there. Roz, did you want to comment? Since I think that was you. You can set me straight if I'm wrong. Yeah. Okay. Did you want to respond?
Yeah, I would say I would say I found it telling, like the firefighter in Florida was saying, that they didn't call that out as rhetoric. They let the two black men look like they were bickering amongst themselves, which I found telling. But I wouldn't call it rhetoric because I grew up going to lectures with Dr. Clark and Dr. Ben, who were very close confidants of his. And he had, and even in this book, they talk about the fact that when the Muslim brother was beaten and at the police station and they wouldn't send him to the hospital, you know, they basically spoke about the fact that Malcolm wanted to avoid violence with his own people, which was why he basically ordered them to leave after, you know, the confrontation. So that's one situation. Another one was when the old friend of his, Bumpy Johnson, actually approached him about getting at Elijah Muhammad and basically assassinating him during the time that they were bickering. And Malcolm, this came directly from Dr. Ben, and Dr. Clark actually spoke to this, where he said, "I don't want any violence amongst black people." So essentially, you know, when Bumpy Johnson found out what was going on between him and Elijah, he offered to kill him, which would have basically, you know, just as far as they were concerned, if he was concerned, solved the problem. And Malcolm didn't want any problems between black people, black on black violence. And he basically said no. So there's different situations in which Malcolm, with his command of the people, could have definitely resorted to violence. But it was out of not wanting to see his people being hurt, I think, that he made those decisions not to go along with violence. So I wouldn't call those things rhetoric. I think it was just something with his understanding of the system of white supremacy. He understood that if he did give the order to set something off seriously on a violent level, that it was a fight that they wouldn't have been able to win. And I think if it was more of a personal thing, like when they bombed his house and he ran outside with the shotgun, at that moment he would have killed anybody he saw, because it was a direct attack on his family that could have killed his children and his wife. So I think that's what it was. It wasn't rhetoric. It was just that in situations you have to be able to outthink your enemy and you have to choose your battles wisely. And I think he made those decisions wisely to protect black life. That's my opinion, and I could be wrong.
Right on. We will get to our second audio segment. If folks want to respond to that, I think Firefighter had more. Just make a note, you should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. We are on Chapter 8, The Great Pretender. This is Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, both suspected racists, blood brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Chapter 8, The Great Pretender. One forgets that though a clown never imitates a wise man, the wise man can imitate the clown. Malcolm X. In November 1961, Roy McHugh, a young reporter from the Evansville Sunday Courier and Press, finally got the assignment he wanted. A feature story on undefeated Kentucky boxer Cassius Clay. He left town early, driving 120 miles from Evansville, Indiana, to Louisville. At the local hotel where Cassius and his group were lodging, McHugh called Angelo Dundee from the house phone. "Come on up," Dundee said. "Cassius is here. You can get acquainted." When he got to Clay's room, the boxer was nowhere to be found. Dundee was the picture of contrition. Cassius had left to avoid the interview, he said. "He's shy, you know. Newspaper men scare him to death." Almost before McHugh could digest the news, Clay rolled out from under a bed and bounced to his feet, laughing like a smooth-cheeked, adolescent prankster. McHugh spent the rest of the day with Cassius, listening to his unconventional trash talk and wild predictions. The reporter was so captivated that he returned to Louisville a year later to gather material for a longer feature for Sport magazine. Again, he spent the day with Cassius, riding in the back seat of his pink Cadillac, while Cassius's brother, Rudy, chauffeured the two around the town. They stopped for gas and a car wash, a haircut, a bite at his parents' home, an evening outing at a bowling alley, and a late-night snack at Big Boy. McHugh watched Clay mooch money, mainly from him, for gas and food, flirt with women, and work a crowd at the bowling alley, greeting diners, shaking hands, and kissing babies. "Listen, folks," his body language said, "I'm running for heavyweight champion, and I'd appreciate your vote." It was a delightful adventure for the sports writer. Cassius seemed to be genuinely open and friendly, as transparent as a picture window. But there were several disquieting moments. Rudy was clearly uncomfortable driving a white man around the black section of Louisville. He was solemn, seldom speaking to McHugh, unless he was asked a direct question. Even then, his answers straddled the line between brevity and rudeness. Whenever they got out of the caddy, at the parents' home in Montclair Villa or the Champion Lane's bowling alley, Rudy would disappear into another room. Rudy's attitude toward the day's activity was an easy read. Only once, silently and secretly, did Cassius reveal his inner thoughts. Twice during the day, Clay ordered stops at the Sensory, Sanitation, Service, Relaxation, Barbershop, where he put coins in a jukebox and chattered with a barber whom he called Country Girl. At one point, when McHugh was looking in another direction, Cassius and Rudy made derisive gestures toward him, pantomiming their true feeling about the white reporter. In a room full of mirrors, however, McHugh had eyes in the back of his head. Deception, of course, was essential to Clay's profession. It was what separated contenders from ham and eggers. The moves Clay made in the ring, all the feints and shifts and creation of openings and avoidance of punishment, were the results of deception. Even outside the ring, deception was essential to Clay's rise to prominence. His outrageous acts, his poetry routines, and his constant boasting hid more than they revealed. As long as he was talking, no one asked what he was thinking. As long as he spent so much time in public, few people wondered what he did in private. He showed only what he wanted others to see. But gradually, what he wanted others to see was changing. In the weeks after Clay defeated Doug Jones, the Louisville sponsoring group became steadily more concerned about reports of his political activities. It was bad enough that he had told Pete Hamill that he had no use for the NAACP and no desire to meet civil rights icon James Meredith, but even more alarming, he used language reminiscent of the Nation of Islam to justify his opinions. It was, he argued, just human nature to be with your own kind. These views contrasted sharply with the benign message of the LSG. While Bill Faversham, the leader of the group, claimed that Cassius's idea of a big time is 4 scoops of ice cream and a double orange juice, Clay was beginning to take controversial social and political stands. The group's leaders believed that he was advancing into dangerous territory at the same moment that he was reaching his biggest paydays. Although Faversham knew little about the Nation of Islam, the few things he did know rang like a fire bell in the night. Most white Americans regarded the Nation as a hate group, a weird cult that believed in spaceships and blue-eyed devils. Clay's association with the organization seemed as dangerous as playing with matches in a munitions factory. It threatened to blow up the LSG's investment and Cassius's title plans. Faversham and LSG lawyer Gordon Davidson refused to intervene in Clay's personal or religious beliefs. They managed his career and business affairs, not his life, but they agreed that a change of scenery was a good idea. A match outside the United States would remove Cassius from the gaze of suspicious reporters and the influence of his black Muslim associates. Although there had been negotiations for matches against Floyd Patterson and George Shavallo in the United States, on April 10th, Clay unexpectedly accepted a deal to fight British heavyweight Henry Cooper in London on June 18th. For months, he had claimed there were only 2 greats in the world, Britain and himself. Now, the two could take stock of each other. Clay invaded England on May 27th. From the moment his TWA flight touched down and he made his way through customs, he confirmed all the worst British notions of brash, overconfident Americans. Soon after his arrival, he verbally attacked his popular opponent. "Cooper's a tramp, a bum, and a cripple, not worth training for. If he talks jive, I'll take him in 5, he announced. His bombast helped him achieve his goal, building interest in the match. Whatever else they thought of him, British sports writers agreed that Gaseous Cassius was a breath of spring for a sport suffering through a long winter. Peter Wilson, the famed Daily Mirror columnist, noted, "There has never been anything quite like it. He came, he saw, and he talked." contributing a stanza of his own, he wrote, "Boxing poet Cassius Clay hit the city yesterday, posing, shouting, full of action, selling Clay, the big attraction." Moving from one publicity stunt to the next, Clay received front-page treatment. Not even the sensational sex spy scandal involving Secretary of State for War John Dennis Profumo and showgirl Christine Keeler was able to best Cassius's show. With his combination of charm and genuine wit, he dazzled British reporters. But every so often, he stopped clowning and jiving and became serious. At those moments, the teachings of Malcolm X, indeed his very words, rolled effortlessly off Clay's tongue. The depth of his political opinions and awareness surprised some reporters. "I know wise people," he said quietly to a group of reporters. "I learn from them." He took what his mentors taught seriously. All the public saw was an act. The role he played was not who he really was. "A wise man can act a fool, but a fool can't act like a wise man," he mused. But what manner of a wise man was Clay? Certainly he was different from other American athletes and entertainers. He eschewed marches and integration, and argued for the complete inequality of the sexes. "The word man means master," he said. "The animals, the trees, the chickens, everything was put here for man. Woman is for man. I see women leading men to the dance floor. That's wrong. The man should lead the woman. The man is master." And, he claimed, he knew who God was and when the world would end. "You're a tough man to cope with, if you know that." The serious Clay mystified reporters more than Cassius the clown. Who was he? Who were the wise people with whom he spoke? What were the sources of his beliefs, if in fact he believed what he said? The journalists had interviewed Floyd Patterson, Sammy Davis Jr., Sidney Poitier, and other black celebrities, but they had not heard any of them speak like Cassius Clay. Nor had they seen antics quite as flamboyant as his. Days before the weigh-in, he had already overstayed his welcome. "Cash has run out of gas," headlined the Daily Mirror. Even the normally laconic Cooper, whose comments had the hard edge of oatmeal, observed, "Surely by now Clay knows that everyone in Britain, including me, hates his guts." But just in case he had a circle of silent supporters, he alienated them too with his weigh-in performance at the London Palladium. Before 2,000 curious spectators who had queued up for the event on a chilly, rainy day, he made a mock royal entrance, wearing an ankle-length red-and-white satin robe with "Cassius Clay, the Greatest" stitched on the back. Strutting about the stage, he opened his hand wide, displaying five fingers, the number of rounds he predicted the fight would last. Unquestionably, Clay had offended, angered, and outraged millions of Britons. "There won't be more than a handful of people hoping to see him win," judged Wilson. "Yet this astonishing young Negro has done more to restore worldwide interest in boxing than any individual since the palmous days of Joe Louis." Clay's entrance for the match in Wembley Stadium was even more elaborate than the weigh-in. Preceded by a band of Coldstream guardsmen and an assortment of British and American soldiers, and wearing an ornate crown, he entered the ring to the sound of trumpets and boos. It was a circus act. A stunned BBC announcer chirped that it was ridiculous. The American had cheapened the game. But Clay only smiled at the waves of jeers and heckles. The noise he heard was in direct proportion to the number of tickets he sold, 35,000, and his take of the gate, about $60,000, wrote Houston Horn of Sports Illustrated. The temperature was in the low 60s, and although the rain had stopped, a thick band of low clouds hung in the bruised sky above Wembley. There were no stars visible in the heavens, but there were dozens at ringside. The most famous was Elizabeth Taylor. At the height of her fame and beauty, Cleopatra had just premiered in New York. She attended the match with her lover and co-star Richard Burton and received what appeared to be a personal bow from Cassius. Clay's opponent, Henry Cooper, had spent his career fighting a perpetual battle against the inevitable. He was a fine boxer, with knockout power in his left hand, but the sharp features of his face, prominent cheekbones, deep-set eyes, and tissue-thin skin rendered him chronically susceptible to cuts. "That's why the people who live off clay selected Cooper," wrote Jimmy Cannon. "The flesh on his face is lined with the scribbling of old scars. A hiccup reopens them." Sooner or later, in any competitive fight, Cooper's face would resemble a scene out of a slasher movie. His goal was always the same: win before the referee stopped the contest. Knowing that Clay's punches were of a peculiarly surgical nature, and that he better score while his eyes were clear of his own blood, Cooper began the fight like he had an early curfew. He rushed Cassius, threw lunging punches, and held and hit in the clinches. Cooper's fans reacted with delight. After one unclean clinch, Clay emerged with a smear of blood on his nose, and the blood this time was not Cooper's. Wembley exploded with cheers. Clay appealed to the referee for justice, but on this night, the 148th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, he found no sympathy. Between rounds, Dundee scolded Clay, telling him to stay out of clinches and fight from the outside. In the second, Cassius did just that, moving and jabbing. By the middle of the round, a dark smudge, like a small grape, appeared under Cooper's left eye. After several more pinprick jabs, the grape split open, and a trail of blood trickled down his face. A round later, another cutting punch above the left eye turned the trickle into a river. The BBC's blow-by-blow man, Simon Smith, informed his listeners, "Cooper's left eye is beginning to look a little bit bad now. This is the sort of thing, of course, that Cassius Clay does. He scientifically and systematically cuts up his opponent, and that's why he stops so many inside the distance." But Cooper's eye was more than a little bit bad. It was literally spurting blood, as if an artery had been sliced open, splattering onto reporters at ringside. In full control of the contest, with still more than a round before the fifth, Cassius virtually stopped punching and began mugging and clowning, shouting boasts to the spectators close to the ring, and sneaking glances at Liz Taylor. He extended his gloves to keep Cooper at arm's length, and popped his gloves in the English fighter's face. He jutted out his chin and challenged Cooper to hit him. "Contemptible cheek," one ringsider muttered. "A show of bad taste and worse sportsmanship," Horn wrote. Sitting at ringside, Bill Faversham was furious. After the round ended, he stormed to Clay's corner, telling Dundee, "Make him stop clowning." But Clay was determined to coast until the fifth, and then fulfill his prediction. Ignoring Faversham's orders, he continued his act, dancing and talking and treating Cooper like a bit player in his Cassius Clay show. In the meantime, Cooper continued to bleed, pawing at his eye like a wounded bear. He looked to Wilson like a red-rimmed cyclops. The British champion could already sense that it was bad. "You don't actually feel a bad cut," he said later. "It just stings and goes numb. What tells you it is a bad one is when you feel the warm blood dripping on your body. This one felt like a tap pouring on my chest." Just before the end of the round, Cooper saw an opening. Perhaps, as Clay later said, he had taken his eyes off Cooper to look at Cleopatra. Regardless, Cooper lunged at him with a sweeping, rising left hook that landed solidly on his cheek. Clay bounced against the ropes, then crumbled to the canvas. His face was blank, like he had just come out of a powerful anesthetic. He rose to his feet quickly, but moved like a drunk, unsteady, uncomprehending, his hands at his side. But the bell sounded immediately. Dundee leaped into the ring and escorted Clay to the corner. "You okay?" Dundee asked. "Yeah, but Cooper's getting tired," Cassius answered. Dundee noticed a small tear in the seam of Clay's left glove. While he lobbied the referee and the British Boxing Board of Control for new gloves, his second broke a vial of smelling salt under Clay's nose, dropped ice cubes into his trunks, and massaged his legs. Later, the legend would grow that Dundee's rant to the authorities gained valuable seconds, even minutes, for Clay to recover before the fifth round. Not so. Clay had recovered fully in the 60 seconds between rounds, and he was ready to make good on his prediction. As Clay threw punches, small tufts of horsehair spit out of the tear in his glove, like spent cartridges, noted one reporter. A punch or two, and blood was flowing from Cooper's eye in sobbing, pulsing spurts, splattering referee Tommy Little. Dressed all in white, the referee looked like he'd been working in an active army field hospital. Blood from the red ruin, which was the left side of Cooper's face, splashed yards out of the ring and onto the paper on which I was writing, wrote Wilson. A reporter for Time magazine said Cooper looked like a man who had just gone through the windshield of a car. Spectators chanted, "Murder! Murder! And stop it! Stop it!" as they threw wadded-up newspapers into the ring. Liz Taylor jumped out of her seat, crying, "No, no, no!" She could not watch any longer. Finally, at the same time as Cooper's corner threw in the towel, Little halted the contest. Back in his dressing room, Cassius praised Cooper. He wasn't a bum and a cripple, he admitted. "He shook me up. He hit me harder than I've ever been hit. I was a little numb." With his performance in England officially over, he was gracious and soft-spoken, almost as if he were auditioning for another role. But more than anything, he wanted to return to America and talk with the wise men he so admired. The day after he fought Cooper, Clay returned to the United States. His victory did little to improve his reputation among boxing scribes. Jimmy Cannon summed up the prevalent opinion. It was clear after the close fight with Doug Jones that Clay didn't qualify as an opponent for Sonny Liston. "There is no doubt about it, now that Cooper has exposed him as a gabby amateur." But he knew that after Liston dispatched Floyd Patterson in their rematch, Clay would get a title shot. Cannon's only suggestion was that the match be held in an emergency ward, saving Cassius a ride in an ambulance. "I don't need Liston," Clay told reporters when he landed at Idlewild Airport, which would be renamed John F. Kennedy Airport at the end of the year. "He needs me." He now fancied himself a world figure, the sort of man who could be plopped down any place on the globe and attract adoring crowds. "I'm very big in those foreign countries. They love me over there," he said. Clay knew he was the draw. The gates for the Archie Moore, Charlie Powell, Doug Jones, and Henry Cooper fights had proved it. But he was reckless in the ring. If Cooper had caught him early in the fourth, rather than just before the bell, Cassius might not have survived the round. The thought gave pause to his sponsors. Clay was now ranked second in the world, and he would advance to first after Liston defeated Patterson. The Louisville sponsoring group saw no reason for him to face another contender. The risk was just too great. Besides, before the end of the year, LSG lawyer Gordon Davidson wrote a sponsor, Clay could earn somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 through public appearances and exhibitions. It seemed that every week he received an offer to perform on a television variety show or make some other appearance. Frank Sinatra wanted Cassius for a major part in a movie. For the small screen, Jack Benny promised to write an entire script about him if he appeared on his show. The producers of Mr. Ed promised similar star treatment, and executives for talent scouts and other television programs requested his services. To be sure, Davidson did not want any of the appearances to prevent Clay from stepping into the ring with Liston with the best possible conditioning and training, and thereby give him the best possible opportunity to defeat the ugly bear. But he supported marketing the boy's national image as a show business personality. Should Liston defeat him, Davidson argued, Cassius could still make money as a comic star. But Cassius was living two lives. Publicly trained by a white man and managed by a consortium of white millionaires, he was also privately advised by Malcolm, Rudy, and a small group of trusted Muslims. His career demanded that he work with the one group, while his psyche depended on him living with the other. Whenever a reporter probed near the heart of the matter, he asserted his independence. Tom Wolfe recalled hearing a phone conversation in New York between Cassius and some man who wanted to set up a business deal. When the man asked to talk to Clay's manager, Cassius exploded.
I don't have no manager. I got a trainer, and he's in Florida. I'm my own boss. I got backers. They put up the money. But I'm the boss. I'm the onlyest boss. This theme, who made me is me, was nothing new. But since moving closer to the nation, Clay had grown more inwardly self-confident and outwardly self-aware. In a conversation with Alex Haley, Malcolm took credit for Cassius's maturation. In general, he said, I taught him that 90% of success would depend upon how alert and knowledgeable he became to the true natures and motives of all the people who flocked around him. Clay absorbed these lessons well. After spending time with the fighter for an Esquire profile, Wolf concluded that Cassius's chief mental asset was that he is quite aware, even supersensitive at times, to other people's motives. He is aware of the newspaper man's motives, his backer's motives, his trainer's motives, autograph hunter's motives, and even the social motives of sophisticated white New Yorkers he has seen only at a glance. Suspicion of white men colored Clay's awareness. When he returned to Louisville a week after the Cooper match, he avoided his white sponsors and spent time on the West Side, entertaining black youngsters and joking with old friends. When a white reporter asked him why he didn't follow Dundee's instructions and try to knock out Cooper in the third round, he replied angrily, I'm the boss in the ring, not Angelo or my backers. They're boss outside the ring, handling money and that stuff. They've got the easy job. Without an upcoming match consuming his time, Clay was free to travel with Rudy and attend more Nation of Islam functions. Doing so, he risked that a journalist might see him at a mosque and reached the obvious conclusion. And it was only a matter of time until the inevitable came to pass. On July 2nd, Bruce Hills, a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, spied a tomato-red Cadillac convertible in an alley behind the nation's University of Islam. He waited, and soon Cassius, Rudy, and another man came out the back door and got into the car. Clay was dressed in conservative Muslim attire and wearing a Star and Crescent NOI membership pin. Since Cassius's Kentucky driver's license had been suspended for repeated traffic infractions, Rudy got behind the wheel and Cassius climbed into the back seat. Two automobiles filled with glowering black Muslims, determined to protect the heavyweight pretender from questions, flanked the Cadillac. But Hills and his driver were determined to get the story, even if it meant a high-speed chase. Out of the alley onto 54th Street, then to Lake Park, and finally to Stony Island, the reporter in his own car dogged Clay, conducting a dangerous, rolling interview. He asked the obvious question, "Are you a black Muslim?" For a block, Cassius considered the question before responding, "No," only to promptly amend his answer to, "I don't know." After another second or two, he added, "I'm for the black Muslims." "Do you believe everything they advocate?" Hills asked. "Listen, I've looked real hard at every organization that's for the black man. This is the greatest one I've found." Then, raising his voice above the roar of traffic, he emphasized, "The black Muslims are the sweetest thing next to God." As the interview continued, Cassius explained that he was in favor of anything good that can happen for the black man, but that he would not participate in any Southern demonstrations. "I don't want anybody to sic dogs on me," he said. Before Rudy turned onto the Skyway and headed toward the Indiana border, Hills asked another question. "Are you afraid your identification with the black Muslims might hurt your boxing career?" "Say, I don't have a record," Clay replied, referring to Sonny Liston's criminal past. A day later, Cassius was already backing away from his answers. To other reporters, he did not deny that the interview had taken place, but he asserted that he hadn't been wearing a black Muslim pin and wasn't a member of any organization. He was still searching for a movement under the leadership of a holy man that offered an eternal solution, and not just a temporary one. A statement that was pulled straight out of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. Besides, he believed that athletes and entertainers did not have the time or experience to lead civil rights groups. Someday, he might join an organization, but until then, he would wait to see which is best.
Malcolm X agreed, at least publicly, that black athletes and entertainers should not define or lead the civil rights movement. On July 22, 1963, the day of the Liston-Patterson rematch in Las Vegas, Malcolm's fight was in Brooklyn, where more than 1,000 protesters were demonstrating against racial discrimination at a hospital construction site. From across the street, where he shook hands and supported the participants, he watched as policemen arrested peaceful protesters and sent them off to the station in paddy wagons. What did a million-dollar contest in Las Vegas have to do with this fight against discrimination? Robert Lipsight, a young New York Times reporter, asked the question for a sidebar to the Liston-Patterson match. "They'll always give us the opportunity to act like animals," responded a black lawyer on the picket line. "We're beyond the point where we can get excited over a Negro hitting a home run or winning a championship," offered another protester. When Lipsight approached Malcolm, he received more than a comment. The minister dismissed the reporter's inquiry with a brusque reply, "That's a stupid question." With that, three shaven-headed members of the Fruit of Islam stepped between Lipsight and Malcolm. "They formed a wall with their chests and walked me into the gutter," the reporter recalled. "The only stupid question is the unanswered question," Lipsight shouted. Smiling, Malcolm nodded to his bodyguards to let the reporter through. "I'm pleased to see that the two best men in the sport are black," he said, "but they'll be exploited, of course, and the promoters will get all the bread. They let a Negro excel if it's going to make some money for them." Ending the conversation, Malcolm said he hoped that Liston would really shake Patterson up. Floyd had attacked the nation. Malcolm, the single-minded revolutionary, obviously knew something about boxing. In Las Vegas, Cassius worked the spectators and sports writers who were in town for the big fight, like he was performing in the showroom. Dressed in a black-and-white houndstooth sports jacket, he strutted around the streets and casinos, belittling the other fighters. According to Cassius, Liston would dispose of Patterson and then have to face him. That would spell the end of Sonny's reign of terror, and the world would be blessed with a new title holder, a pretty champion, in stark contrast with the big ugly bear. As he told several journalists, "That poor old man, he's so ugly, his wife drives him to the gym every morning before the sun comes up, so nobody'll have to look at him around home." Generally, Liston endured the verbal assaults, realizing that it was Clay's shtick, part of the promotion scheme to get people interested in a match between them. But Sonny was a violent, unpredictable man who, given his mood of the moment, was apt to take offense. That was precisely what happened a few days before the Liston-Patterson match. Sonny was shooting craps and losing money at the Thunderbird Hotel. "Liston was a mean-tempered son of a bitch," recalled publicist Harold Conrad, "and he was losing, so naturally he's mad. Liston picks up the dice and throws craps, and there's a big silence." Then a sharp voice cracked the hushed stillness. "Look at that big ugly bear, he can't even shoot craps," called out Clay, leaning against a wall close to the game. Liston glared, rolled again, and once more threw craps. Again the insouciant voice. "Look at the big ugly bear. He can't do nothing right." It was the voice of a man about to walk the plank. Liston had reached the limit of his limited patience. Walking over to Cassius, he fixed him with a dead-eyed stare and said, "Listen, you nigger faggot. If you don't get out of here in 10 seconds, I'm going to pull that big tongue out of your mouth and stick it up your ass." A New York Times reporter who watched the confrontation said that Liston also slapped Clay hard across his face, but Conrad swore that there was no slap, just the hard eyes and violent threat, and promised that worse was to come. Clay walked away. "He scared the shit out of him. You better believe it," Conrad said. Cassius agreed. "That big ugly bear scared me bad." But Cassius returned for the title fight, determined to upstage Liston and Patterson. When the announcer introduced him before the match, he slipped gracefully between the ropes, shook hands with Patterson, and started to walk toward Liston. Halfway there, he froze in mock horror, raised his hands in a gesture of surrender, and fled the ring.
The pantomime drew laughter and applause. "Our boy stole the show completely," Gordon Davidson wrote a member of the LSG. As it turned out, the fight itself proved no competition for the Cassius Clay show. In another one-sided match, Liston again knocked out Patterson in the first round. A reporter for Time summed up the contest. "Like a man killing a rabbit with a stick, he clubbed the hapless challenger to the canvas, gracelessly and methodically, his sulfur and obsidian eyes betraying neither pleasure nor anger." To the dismay of sports writers, Liston seemed indestructible, a fighter who was likely to hold the title for years. "He's here for keeps," noted Jim Murray. "It is like finding a live bat on a string under your Christmas tree." And sports writers believed that there was no one in boxing who could get rid of him. Liston, commented columnist Arthur Daly, was arrogant, surly, mean, rude, and altogether frightening. And nobody, not even the loudmouth from Louisville, had a chance against him. Cassius, however, did not think that Liston was invincible. After the fight, he was loud and obnoxious, at one point grabbing the TV theater microphone and announcing his intentions to close-circuit viewers. It was all, Daly thought, a bit shabby. The exceedingly likable Clay is lousing up his public relations by his boasting, and it's high time he eases off and lets his fists serve as his spokesman. Unfortunately, they don't speak anywhere near as eloquently as his vocal cords. Yet Clay's ongoing vaudeville routine was going exactly as planned. By mid-1963, he thought of himself more as an entertainer than a boxer, identifying with Sam Cooke and Elvis Presley more than Sonny Liston and Floyd Patterson. When Tom Wolfe interviewed him, he referred to himself as a show business figure. "I don't feel I'm in boxing anymore. It's show business." When it was showtime, his 150-watt eyeballs lit up, and he went into his act. He wants to be thought of as a man who does the clown act consummately well, which is to say, an actor, Wolfe observed. He aspired not to Liston's title, but to Elvis Presley's. He wanted to be the king, king of the world. Pursuing that goal, after attending the title fight, he went to Columbia Studios in New York to cut a spoken word LP entitled "I Am the Greatest." Cassius claimed that he wrote everything on the record and predicted it would outsell comedian Vaughn Meader's enormously popular spoof of the Kennedy family. In truth, the LP was a collaborative production, filled with sophisticated comic material written by Gary Belkin. When they first met, Belkin was shocked by Clay's reading problems. Clay was in fact an undiagnosed dyslexic, and Belkin judged him a functional illiterate, and set about composing lengthy poems to go with Cassius's basic couplets. People assumed that Clay wrote such poems as "I Am the Greatest" and "Will the Real Sonny Liston Please Fall Down?", and that he actually came up with the line that he was so pretty that his face should be considered a natural resource and preserved by the Secretary of the Interior, as opposed to Liston, whose face should be appropriated by the Bureau of Wildlife. But he did not create his material any more than Presley wrote the hundreds of songs he recorded. What Clay provided was the Louisville lip character, and during the production of the record, he worked diligently to weave the material into his persona. He memorized poems, questioned the comic material, and helped shape the finished product. That many of the cuts became permanent routines in his repertoire demonstrates how carefully and successfully he played his part. Away from the studio, accompanied by the ever-present Rudy and a few black friends, Cassius ventured into Harlem. There, he attended NOI rallies and had private meetings with Malcolm. By the summer of 1963, after 3 years of feature stories about him in Time, Life, Ebony, Jet, Sports Illustrated, and other national publications, scores of television appearances, and his photograph in hundreds of newspaper stories, Clay's face was too well known to go unrecognized. On August 10th, he attended an outdoor rally on the corner of 115th Street and Lenox Avenue, where Malcolm spoke to a large audience about the upcoming March on Washington. The nation, he said, would not participate in the march,
which he suggested had been hijacked by the Kennedy administration. When the white man found out he couldn't stop the march, he decided to join it, he claimed. It was just another example of black men with white hearts, and of the fact that Martin Luther King and his ilk had too cozy a relationship with white politicians. An undercover agent from the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services spied Cassius Clay at the rally, listening intently to Malcolm. Now the top-ranked heavyweight contender, Clay was far from being an invisible man. On August 28, 1963, the entire country focused its attention on the nation's capital for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The television networks assigned hundreds of people to cover the march, setting up dozens of cameras between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. On the morning of the demonstration, more than 2,000 buses, 21 special trains, 10 chartered flights, and armies of cars converged on the Capitol. From all over the country, thousands of people, young and old, black and white, came to D.C. to witness a historic occasion. Elijah Muhammad had forbidden his followers from joining. In the months leading up to the Freedom March, FOI captains reminded the faithful that there were serious consequences for violating his edict. In Chicago, Supreme Captain Raymond Sharif issued a directive. "Let me put it more clearly to you. Do not participate in these demonstrations. If you are caught, you will wish you were dead." Although Malcolm publicly maintained that no black Muslim would attend the march, he could not resist being near the center of the action. After Muhammad granted him special permission, he traveled to the Capitol to witness what he called the farce on Washington. In the lobby of the Statler Hilton Hotel, he engaged young demonstrators and reporters, offering political opinions, but never divulged his frustrations with the nation's disengagement from the movement. Later that afternoon, sitting in his hotel room, he watched Martin Luther King deliver his iconic "I Have a Dream" speech, an idealistic vision of interracial brotherhood. When reporters asked him what he thought about the Freedom March, Malcolm compared it to a sporting event. The Rose Bowl game, the Kentucky Derby, and the World Series, the kind of event where people went simply to say, "I was there." The Freedom March had done nothing but create false hope for blacks, he insisted. A few weeks later, Malcolm traveled to Chicago to visit Elijah. Before he arrived at the mansion, C. Eric Lincoln, the author of The Black Muslims in America, waited in the foyer to meet the Supreme Minister. He wondered how Elijah would receive him, since many Muslims had expressed dissatisfaction with his book. One angry minister told him that he wanted to burn them as fast as they came off the presses. But Elijah greeted him with a firm handshake and welcoming eyes, though he did not smile. In fact, Lincoln thought, he had never seen him smile, except moments later when Malcolm entered the living room. Elijah embraced Malcolm, kissing him gently on both cheeks, and asked about Betty and their children. Lincoln never suspected friction between them. "There was genuine affection here between these two," he observed, "not unlike the affection between a father and son who has done well for the family name." If Malcolm felt uneasy being around Elijah, he masked his anxiety. Lincoln sensed that the bond between them was stronger than ever. After they all sat down, the messenger lectured the ministers, while Malcolm dutifully wrote notes, transcribing his every word. Since their meeting in Phoenix, Malcolm had submitted, getting Elijah's permission before doing anything, like he should have been doing all the time. Lincoln was unaware that Malcolm's faith in the messenger had already begun to erode. The next day, September 15th, Malcolm learned that the Ku Klux Klan had bombed Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, killing four young black girls. As the father of three daughters and another on the way, he could well imagine the pain the parents suffered. He bristled at calls for turning the other cheek. The bombing was a brutal reminder, he said, that the March on Washington had failed. The Negroes spent a lot of money, had a good time, and enjoyed a real circus or carnival atmosphere, he told a reporter. Now that the show is over, the black masses are still without land, without jobs, and without homes.
Their Christian churches are still being bombed, their innocent little girls murdered. So, he asked the writer, what did the March on Washington accomplish? Nothing.
Emphatic ending for this week's session of Blood Brothers. We will pick up there next week. We are kind of at the end of Chapter 8, kind of. We'll pick up there for next week, though. Folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last minute. If you think you have something you would like to share, go ahead and get your hand up right now. Let us not lollygag. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Roz Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, Mr. Demi Four. I'll look for other folks if they dial in. Feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Briefly, when Clay was fighting Cooper over in England, he appealed to the referee during the fight for justice, I guess, after an unclean clinch. It said, but on this night, the 148th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, he found no sympathy. It's just mind-boggling, you know, how deep this hatred and anti-blackness goes globally. You know, they going to schedule this fight, you know, on an anniversary date of their nation because they thought Cooper was going to finally shut Cassius Clay up. And, you know, it's noteworthy that the book was saying that Bill Faversham didn't interfere in his personal life or whatever, but he runs over to the corner and wants Dundee to make him stop clowning when he was going through his antics like he always do. And then Liz Taylor is over there standing in the front seat. She's an American. She should have been on the side of the American, but when Clay started beating the guy, the author was saying, well, it said someone said that Clay's hands were like knives or something, cutting up the man's face. And Liz Taylor jumped up shouting, stop it, stop it. She couldn't, no, she couldn't take it any longer. And all the white people in there were shouting murder and stop it and all that. The whole white team just got together. It didn't matter what nation they were actually from, but when it comes to a black man beating down a white man, they all come together there like Voltron. And some man asked Clay, who was his manager, but he exploded back and said, I don't have no manager. I got a trainer, and he's in Florida. I'm my own boss. I got backers. They put up the money, but I'm the boss. I'm the onlyest boss. The one, yeah, the onlyest boss. You know, that just brings up a thought that, you know, we may think that we're independent, and you know what, we may actually live our lives in some type of resemblance of independence, but you have to always be aware that you're in a system of white supremacy, and that in a system of white supremacy, you are not your own boss, no matter how it appears. But they got this one writer, Tom Wolfe, that interviewed Cassius. And he said that Cassius referred to himself as a show business figure. I don't feel I'm in boxing anymore. It's show business. And then in his own words, he said, or in Tom Wolfe's words, when it was showtime, his 150-watt eye bulbs lit up, and he went into his act. He wants to be thought of as a man who does the clown act consummately well, which is to say an actor, Wolf observed. It's just, you know, no end to this obvious acts of racism in both the newspapers, the journalists, in the pictures that they were taking, deliberately showing him darker than what he actually was, just to vilify the man. But at the same time, Cooper was talking, saying he was the greatest thing. First it was Britain and then him. But there was no negativism associated with him bragging, but always on Cassius Clay. But I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call.
Can I be heard again?
We can hear you. I just want to pause 1 second because there's one person that dialed in that we have not heard from at all. The caller, 4231, 4231, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, peace to the callers, to the host, and to the platform. I just wanted to comment on the fact that, you know, while I'm hearing this book, you know, it just makes me think about the current times of the Crusades that's ongoing and, you know, how, you know, it's this racism, white supremacy being acted out in the area of religion through Christianity or Catholicism, to kind of be specific. And, you know, just his whole transition being called Cassius Clay and then Muhammad Ali, you know, I think that's significant. And when they were talking about, you know, that, you know, having some power to, I heard somebody mention, like, having some power to retaliate or be on self-defense. And I just see it as racism, white supremacy didn't allow Black people to have another religious concept, even if it was something close to the paradigm that they're in. And I think that what happened with Nation of Islam and the whole Malcolm X thing kind of proves that, you know, Nation of Islam is kind of a spinoff, so to say, of the actual Islam, because it included some Black theology, so to say, Islamic teachings, and then, you know, we didn't really get going with that. But I do think, like Malcolm X thought, that, you know, with the real version of it, so to say, that it would empower Black people to a certain extent, maybe. But I just saw the Nation of Islam as a throw off. That's all I wanted to say.
Right on. Appreciate the patience. Retired firefighter, do you have commentary, sir?
Yes, sir. I don't have a book, but, you know, from following the readings, it places my mind to where Black males were in the people activity of entertainment / sports. As far as team sports, it still was, you know, very few non-white Black males. Baseball was being supplanted by football at that time. But Jim Brown would tell you there was very few Black males. There was a quota system in the NFL. The AFL had not merged at that time with the NFL yet, but yet they were quickly obtaining more Black males than the NFL was, and they were paying them more money at the time. but primarily was still a situation whereas black males were relatively quiet or not being interviewed, I put it that way, so much. Baseball, although Jackie Robinson created an atmosphere to whereas more black males were being hired into the major leagues, it still was a small amount. I said all of that to say, well, and then you had track and field, but that at that time was still a quote unquote amateur sport. I said all that to say that, and we haven't even gotten to 1964 when he was 22 years old. I keep reminding myself that, of the person by the name of Cassius Clay at that time, 62, 63, was no more than about 20, 21 years old. And he, although of all of the dyslexia that he has had, the way the school system under the, which of course is backed up and paid for by the system of racist white supremacy, failed him. He was able to self-promote himself in a way that actually hasn't been surpassed by any single athlete. And he was, you know, he actually did was very prevalent by his personality into making millions of dollars for other people. Put it that way. That tells me that's one reason why, although significant people knew that he was a member of the Nation of Islam, that they didn't put it out there, because white people have always shown to be very coy, very shrewd when it came to maintaining their power and or authority within the nation, within the system of racist white supremacy, to get the most out of anything, especially a non-white black person. They certainly did in this particular case as we are reading. At the same time, with the assistance of the technology and the racist white supremacists actively involved, they had already isolated out to a large extent Minister Malcolm X, and was creating an atmosphere that was very hostile, that we know that would lead to his death. I remember in the first reading, I kind of like briefly heard it, but it said something about, and maybe you can quickly tell me about it on what it actually meant. They said something about to don't say something to Minister Lewis. I know who they're talking about. They're talking about Minister Farrakhan. But what did that actually mean? In the first reading, what did that? What? Give me more clarity on that phrase was about.
If I am paraphrasing, and I'm going to flip back and see if I can get the exact page, but he was saying that when Minister Malcolm went to Elijah Muhammad about his sexual activity and having these children, he told him that, you know, you can discreetly discuss this matter with some of the other ministers, so you can kind of prepare them for how we want people to think about this. But he did not want him to tell, who later became Louis Farrakhan, he did not want him to tell Minister Lewis. And it said after that this was a test to see if he could trust, if Elijah Muhammad could trust Minister Malcolm. If he complied and didn't share this information with who became Louis Farrakhan, that, you know, he could be trusted.
Wow. I'm wowing because I have heard and read on several accounts that he did go to Minister Farrakhan. He actually did go to Minister Farrakhan and I heard this come out of Minister Farrakhan's mouth, that he actually came to him and talked to him about that particular situation. He actually did do it. So like I said before, because I'm putting my focus on white people, powerful white people under the global system of racist white supremacy, they, just like the Black Panther Party and other efforts, the SCLC, other efforts that were attempting to neutralize the global system of racism, they all played a factor in, and there are different methods. Some of them were the exact same, some with subtle nuances. They were able to destroy based on one particular figure that may be from a charismatic standpoint, be instrumental to it in making that situation better. They would either destroy that person individually and in turn destroy the collective efforts. They're very consistent at that. And as we speak, they're doing it now. As we speak, they're doing it. They're orchestrating and they're doing it now. You know, of course, it would either be through the persona of Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump. But that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
That portion where he mentions, you know, don't tell Brother Louis X, that is footnoted from The Messenger, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad, which is authored by Carl Evans, who is a black male. He also wrote The Judas Factor, which is about the assassination of Malcolm X and government involvement in that. Also gives a lot of background information on the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, blah, blah, blah. But it is quoted from The Messenger, Carl Evans, and it's page 262 if you are interested in doing any digging.
I just wanted to insert one more small tidbit I don't think they mentioned fully. One of the things that Cassius Clay did in the fight with Henry Cooper, he came into the ring with a robe on and a king's crown on his head, which I don't think they mentioned it in the reading, which really whipped the audience into a hurricane of hate, you know, against them. A black male parading around in the ring with a king's crown on his head. There's a picture of it that I have in a magazine on him. When he did that, because he fought Henry Cooper actually twice. And yes, if you actually saw the fight itself, which you can see it, it was bloody gore. Bloody gore, both fights. That's all. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, I wanted to ask you, before this book came out, Did you say that Muhammad Ali did approve it, like approve of what they wrote before this book came out?
I'm not aware if Muhammad Ali, if they got his approval. Like sometimes when you see a biography, it'll say the authorized or unauthorized. I'm not aware if Muhammad Ali approved it. I know it did. It was published this year, just months before he passed, I think like in the spring of this year.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is because one thing I noticed about white people is when you're reading a book, especially a book that's a biography, and you find a running theme, there's something that a message they're trying to convey. And what I find is in the beginning of the second reading, again, they speak to him being deceptive. And they did it twice in this session alone, and then prior to this, they did it quite a few times. So it's my belief that they, in some way, are trying to criminalize him. And it's just ridiculous how they actually they focus on this entire concept of him being deceptive, and I just think it's just a form of just criminalization of him both in the ring and out of the ring, because the context in which they always seem to place it is in the context of something negative, which always deception is presented in a negative way, or in a way in which they are practicing racism simply because they are completely avoiding the fact that it's racism, white supremacy that is facilitating that form of deception that probably wouldn't have existed if this system of white supremacy wouldn't exist or wasn't in existence. So I just find that to be a very poignant act of racism, because it's coming up way too often, this whole theme of him being so deceptive and his deception being almost legendary, the way they discuss it and the nuances with which they speak about it. I find that to be very telling. Also, there was a section on... there's a section where they write this, it's on page 125, they write this theme who made me is me, it was nothing new. But since moving closer to the nation, Clay had grown more inwardly self-confident and outwardly self-aware. In a conversation with Alex Haley, Malcolm took credit for Cassius's maturation. In general, he said, I taught him that 90% of success would depend on how alert and knowledgeable he became to the true natures and motives of all the people who flocked around him. Clay absorbed these lessons well. After spending time with the fighter for an Esquire profile, Wolf concluded that Cassius's chief mental asset was that he was quite aware, even super sensitive at times, to other people's motives. He is aware of the newspaper man's motives, his backer's motives, his trainer's motives, autograph hunter's motives, and even the social motives of sophisticated white New Yorkers he has seen only at a glance. And I just found that to be interesting because that Minister Malcolm speaking of, or taking, as they say, as they wrote, taking credit for his maturation as far as helping to facilitate his understanding of being aware of people is something that I find it's interesting because that is something that you learn on the streets. And Muhammad Ali wasn't from the streets, so it's just very interesting that he was able to take that sort of awareness in the situation in dealing with people and facilitate helping at that time Cassius Clay be able to apply that to the people who were around him. I just found that to be brilliant because I remember a while ago, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was on the documentary, the episode that Gil Noble did on Like It Is regarding Minister Malcolm X. And I remember there was a black male who I believe was killed by the police. And I think it was in New York City or in one of the black cities across America. And in the clip, they were talking about the fact that when Malcolm had his paper, the author of the article actually called the guy a murderer. And Malcolm had told him to change that word to killer because he knew that legally they could be sued. And, of course, they didn't have the money to deal with, like, a libel suit or anything like that. And just in him being able to be that astute, to understand words so intimately that he was able to actually have this black reporter revise that wordplay in order to basically expose the police officer for what he did, which was actually, you know, kill a black person. But not put himself in a legal quandary where he could, you know, end up facing the destruction of his paper based on some sort of a lawsuit. So I just found that to be a very interesting little tidbit that they included there. And I found at the very end of the reading when the author was reading about the March on Washington. And at the end, he said, what did the March on Washington accomplish? Nothing. And he was quoting Minister Malcolm X. I found that that entire reading was read in such a white supremacist fashion because he understood that the march actually didn't accomplish anything as a white male. And the fact that Malcolm analyzed it so I would say vividly, you can hear the conviction in his white supremacist vocalizing of that final paragraph before we came to the end. And like I said, I think that's something we should really pay attention to is how he speaks, how he enunciates his words, because I think it really gives insight into the motives of the people who wrote this book. And I would love to get them on this program so we can talk to them about the contents of this work. Thank you.
Thomas in New York, did you have anything to add? Reckon he might be just listening in. Appreciate great comments, great analysis, all the folks who chimed in. Things I will share from the second portion that we heard. Number one, if you all want to check out that book, The Messenger, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad by Carl Evans, it's page 262, where you can read the paragraph where they're talking about Elijah Muhammad telling Minister Malcolm not to share this information with Louis X, who later became Louis Farrakhan. You can check it out for yourself. They almost took it verbatim straight out of the text. Also, that was Peter Bailey, the journalist Ross just mentioned, where Minister Malcolm advised him to change the wording from murder to kill Mr. Bailey, black journalist. He was on Democracy Now! Last year for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X in February, and he talked about that incident specifically and his relationship with Minister Malcolm last February. You can go back in the archives and check that out at Democracy Now! Some of the other things that stood out from the chapter where this white reporter, Mr. McHugh, where he comes in to interview Muhammad Ali, and they're kind of taking him around town, and they go to this black bar, and they're kind of, you know, making fun of this white guy. It's like the white guy is so crafty. There are mirrors everywhere. He can see all of this. These, you know, no-count Negroes are not able to slip anything over on Mr. McHugh. He's able to see all of this and catch what it is they're doing. He says it's like he has eyes in the back of his head. I thought that was another fascinating little wrinkle of the white authors coming through the racism and how this gets retold. And that right after that, it goes into, again, deception, of course, was essential to Clay's profession, which I think you all have pointed out. That seems to be one of the major themes in the book, describing Muhammad Ali as a deceptive liar and what he's doing and just really hammering that home every chapter in vivid detail, the way that he gets classified. The next portion where I think, too, some of the racism and just in the perception of Muhammad Ali, I think some of that even comes through not just with the authors of this book, but even from that time, his contemporaries, where they say Bill Faversham, he's one of the white owners of this Louisville sponsoring group, where he says that his idea of big time is four scoops of ice cream and a double orange juice. That almost reminds me the folks who heard our discussion on The Purge, where Irish Eyes, where he says, all I think about in life is waffles and sex. Not in those words, but same type of view of black people, that these are just buffoons, clowns, they're just little nigger children. I don't care how old they are. This is how whites think of us. You see, you hear that expressed all the time. Let's see. I think the concern that these whites, I think it was retired firefighter, he talked about the white people in this group, the Louisville sponsoring group, that they knew of Cassius Clay's involvement with Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, that they were not upset. I think last week we talked about that, this information not leaking widely to the press earlier than it did, because they had a vested interest in protecting their Negro to make sure that they get their investment back and try to make as much as they could off of him. So they had a vested interest in making sure that whites were not being reckless and disseminating this information to the public. I thought this was another telling paragraph as well, in terms of just the authors and having whites write this type of material about black people, important black people, and their racism coming through, where it says it's talking about his style of promotion, him going out and doing all these antics, which is selling fights, getting him more, getting his name in the press, making him a bigger commodity. Smart thing to do, intelligent thing to do. I think Floyd Mayweather has mastered that throughout his long, colorful, and extremely successful career. He says the depth of his political opinions, talking about Cassius Clay, and awareness surprised some reporters. I know wise people, he said quietly to a group of reporters. I learn from them. He took what his mentors taught seriously. All the public saw was an act. The role played was not who he really was. A wise man can act a fool, but a fool can't act like a wise man, he mused. The very next paragraph, they say, and this is their words, not a quote. This is directly from the authors. But what manner of wise man was Clay? It reminds me of the first audio segment we read today when he was giving his Cassius Clay giving his appraisal of the NAACP, and they say, oh, this unsophisticated knowledge of this group, who is he to be, you know, off talking about white people controlled it. This same sort of really subtle demeaning, that he's just a liar, Cassius Clay. He's deceptive, he's sneaky, he's a liar, and, you know, how smart, how wise is he really to be talking all of this? I think that really, really significant, just in the way that that's written. Right after that, they come by in this comparison. I think this is a standard tactic amongst racists where they get one Negro and they will compare you to someone else on the plantation, a different Negro, and say, well, wait a minute, Cassius, you know, why don't you behave more like Sammy Davis Jr.? Why don't you behave more like Sidney Poitier? Or why don't you behave, you know, like someone that they think of as a quote-unquote responsible Negro? Why don't you behave more like him? This was such, you know, he was so nice and kept his mouth shut and didn't do all this. Why can't you be more like these people? And they might even go talk to them. Well, what do you think about, you know, this loudmouth Cassius Clay? What do you think about the civil rights movement, to see if they have something that is more akin to how racists want us to think? I also thought it was significant when they give their kind of roll call of other people that he's kind of being juxtaposed to: Sidney Poitier, Sammy Davis Jr. Let's see, what else do we have in the second? I'll just get a couple quick things in and just leave the rest for next week. When they quote Muhammad Ali, when he says, I'm the boss of me, that these folks, I made me, that these folks, they're just, you know, backers and what have you. When he says that I'm the boss in the ring, not Angelo or my backers, they're the boss outside the ring, handling money and that stuff. That kind of made me cringe, because that train of thought has led to many, 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 many destitute black people, not just boxers, athletes, entertainers, you name it, whites being boss of the finances. Oh my, this can always spell catastrophe. I thought it was important as well when they talked about Muhammad Ali having all of these traffic citations, kind of reminding me of Sonny Liston. No matter how much money you have, you can have your cherry or your tomato Cadillac, and you're still just another nigger, and driving while black, as they say, driving under racism, white supremacy, even if you are a top-ranked prize fighter. I thought it was a great passage where they're talking to some of the protesters, and they say they'll always give us the opportunity to act like animals, responded a black lawyer on the picket line. We're beyond the point where we can get excited over a Negro hitting a home run or winning a championship. Great line, and I think that should hold for 2016 as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Really appreciated their commentary about the March on Washington. We talked about that extensively when we did Malcolm X's autobiography last year. You can go back and listen to that in the archives. We talked about, in my view, his just amazingly accurate, perceptive, comprehensive analysis of the March on Washington for Minister Malcolm's thoughts. I would encourage folks to check out Message to the Grassroots, where he goes really into detail about what happened August 28th, 1963. Incredible analysis, and we've talked about that in depth on the program repeatedly over the years. Again, in the surveillance, just make sure I get that in again, where it says an undercover agent from the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services, the Boss Division, spied Cassius Clay at the rally listening intently to Malcolm. Just again, in my view, that should really be front and center, more than us focusing on how deceptive Muhammad Ali is, or talking about the clowning antics of the Nation of Islam. In my view, really emphasizing the widespread government-sanctioned illegal surveillance of the Nation of Islam, Minister Malcolm, Cassius Clay, and black people across the board of this period of time that cannot be minimized. It certainly continues 21st century with all the technology and what have you that they have, but that should be at the center of all of this, exacerbating conflict, creating conflict, creating assassinations and all this type of thing. That should really be at the forefront of this. And again, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, Racial Matters, the FBI Secret File on Black America from 1960 to 1972. Great read, unfortunately written by a racist suspect. We had him on the program back in April of 2009. We will stop there. We'll be back next week. We are kind of at the end of Chapter 8. We are beyond the halfway point in the book. We should probably have four more of these to go. It might be five, just depending on how it goes, but definitely four to go. If you listen to the archives, drop an email if you have commentary, thoughts you would like to share. We can read them as we go with the book. Probably by next week, I'll be able to give an idea about what the next book will be, since we'll be kind of getting towards the home stretch after next week's reading. With that, we'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on news, observations from the past 7 days. Certainly, we'll be here on Monday. Sue Africa, white female member of the MOVE organization will be visiting with us. Very much excited about that. And we'll also be here on Tuesday, Antoinette Harrell. She wrote about the Dozier School in Florida, retired firefighter, where they had lots of abused black children being sexually mistreated, raped, killed, just gruesome history in the annals of white supremacy. She'll be with us on Tuesday. Thanks to all the folks for tuning in. Hope it's been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Once again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, especially if you're going to be in a vehicle. If they ended up taking Muhammad Ali's license away as a top-ranked prize fighter, they for sure would have no problem harassing, raping, killing, spying on you, me, any other Negro worldwide plantation. If you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be under the influence, driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. You're making the job of the Darren Wilson's, Daniel Holtzclaw's of the world much easier if you are intoxicated when they flash those lights behind your vehicle. Let's also make sure we're buckled up every time we're in an automobile. Just anything that we can possibly do to minimize contact with enforcement officers, whites in general, badge or no. Let's not be lax on our codification even as we try to go out and maybe have a little bit of fun in the summer sun. With that, thanks again for everyone tuning in, and we'll be back in about 24 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every area of people, activity, whenever we're in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.